Everyone's feeling fed and ready for
okay,
a little
good,
more discussion.
Good.
We're going to take up Senator Hayden, Senate file. What are we doing first, Senator Hayden? 1099?
Yep.
Senate file 1099.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now, by way of introduction, Senate file 1099, there are provisions in this bill that though it may be very important, we do not have a fiscal note for yet, and we are going to ask Senator Hayden to remove those as we go through the bill. Those that are just an appropriation or do have fiscal estimates for, we will discuss and lay the balance, have a motion to lay the balance of Senate File 1099 on the table after the introduction and discussion. Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Senate Bill 1099. As you said, it is the kind of safety net bill. As you can see, members, there was a lot of provisions here that we think are fantastic and that help the most needy folks in our community, that also helps us to keep them out of places like the emergency room and other places that drive up health care costs. Mr. Chair, if it's your pleasure, do you want me to go through the provisions that we're going to strike, or do you want to do the intro and then go step by step? Whatever your pleasure.
You can choose. I mean, you have the.
Well, why don't we do this
pager that goes through section by section? Maybe you can just introduce the section, you know, say why you think it's important, and if we need to strike it, strike it. I don't know if that's a decent approach or not.
Well, and I know that we have a lot. I know that I'm under a time constraint, so why don't I just go through the sections that we are going to strike, say a little bit about them. We have Section 2, which is health disparities. We think that is critically important to collect that data in order to try to get a baseline and figure out this issue around health disparities. However, there is a cost to it, so I am going to move to strike Section 2.
Okay.
Section 3, do you want to talk a little?
Sure. My name is Emily Zill. I serve as staff to the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition. In Section 3, it had been requiring that the statewide quality measurement system be adjusted on those characteristics of race, ethnicity, and language in order to adjust for the socioeconomic factors that affect health disparities related to Section 2 of the data that we are collecting there.
Once again, Mr. Chair, we found that was extremely important, but we are still, we just don't have the fiscal note. Section 4, public input on health disparities, is particularly tough for me. I think that one of the things that we have to do and we have to do better is to talk to the people experiencing these issues that we're trying to help. But today we are going to have to eliminate Section 4. Section 7, let's be Zoll, talk a little bit about that and what that was trying to do.
Section 4?
No, Section 7.
Oh, Section 7. Section 7 was establishing a critical access payment for home care providers. There are a small number of home care providers who see a disproportionate share of patients who are uninsured or on public programs, and the critical access payment program is a way to give them an enhanced rate for those populations that they see. So it was establishing a new payment mechanism for them.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Section 9 is our newly named Voyager Care Health Coverage. That was really going to extend services for low-income Minnesotans that couldn't get on any other program. That was kind of an extension of the EMA program that we've been dealing with a lot. Once again, we want to take another look at this, and I really give a lot of gratitude to the advocates that came up with, I think, a fantastic name for this program, but right now we just can't take it up.
Sure. Section 10 was an increase to critical access dental provider rates and expanding the categories of providers who would be eligible for that. And this relates, we have a number of sections in our bill about critical access. And the critical access payment program was a way to partially compensate for the lower public program rates that and the higher social complexity that safety net providers see. And so this was an enhanced payment rate for those providers. And this is a vital payment rate and enhanced subsidy that many of our safety net providers could not continue to see the large number of uninsured and public program participants without these kinds of rates. And some of that section is, I know, in some other bills as well, but this was proposing an increase to that critical access dental payment rate.
Which one are we on?
11.
You can talk about that.
start. And I'll also talk about the teledentistry and mobile dental services. Again, this was a one we didn't have the fiscal note for, but our safety net dental providers continue to look for ways to expand access and serve their patients in a cost-effective way, and current policy doesn't allow for reimbursement for teledentistry or mobile dental units, and this was changing that policy.
Okay. So do you have a motion, Senator Hayden, to strike those?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, I would move that we strike those, Section 2, 3, 4, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 14.
Okay. You talked a little bit, I thought, about Section 7, but that one's staying in. Is that correct?
Oh, Section 7 as well.
Okay, so Senator Hayden moves orally to strike Sections 2, 3, 4, 7, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 14. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Hayden. And then that leaves us Section 1, 5, 6, 8, and 13. So on those provisions that remain in the bill, Senator Hayden.
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that Ms.
Zilla.
Zilla is going to walk us through the bill. And we will, Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment that I'd like to offer maybe at the end of the presentation, and Mr. Godfrey will come on and talk to us about it.
Ms. Zilla.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, I'm here on behalf of the Safety Net Coalition, and, you know, our safety net providers are the ones whose missions include serving those uninsured and low-income patients and others who face barriers to obtaining their care, often due to their income, language, race, ethnicity, or disabilities. And our safety net providers choose to serve the most complex, disadvantaged, and diverse patients who often need more time with providers due to those language, literacy, or cultural barriers. And they also need, oftentimes, those additional enabling and wraparound services, such as the interpreters, housing assistance, transportation, and the culturally competent staff to help them access their health care. In spite of this high complexity of their patients and the extra time that the providers spend serving with them, safety net providers often receive fewer resources because they have many uninsured and underinsured patients, and because they have a high concentration of people in public programs where payment rates are low. And unlike mainstream providers, safety net providers don't have the ability to cost shift their financial losses from serving those uninsured. And the low MA rate patients, it's only a small portion of their patient base are privately insured. You know, the governor's health care reform task force had included a number of recommendations in their report to specifically look at ways to strengthen our safety net. And those, unfortunately, those recommendations weren't in his governance budget, but we wanted to bring some of them forward for you today, because we really think it's important to target those resources to the patients and the providers who have the most need and who are the most vulnerable. So the things that are left in our bill here today that we'd like to quickly highlight are either those mechanisms, those policy measures that will help ensure that those providers can continue to exist and serve those patients, and that they can continue to serve the patients in a cost-effective and efficient way. So the first section I want to speak to is the essential community provider language. And under existing law, health insurance companies are required to contract with certain state-designated safety net providers who offer those special services to low-income patients. And this helps ensure that all enrollees who need these types of services are able to obtain them regardless of what health coverage they have. So this bill amends the existing essential community provider law to ensure that that requirement applies to Minnesota Care and any new basic health program and plans offered through the exchange. The next section in the bill that's left is Section 5, the Emergency Medical Assistance. And we are proposing some changes there, similar to what the governor has proposed in his budget, to continue coverage for cancer and dialysis, and to also allow for the Department of Human Services to pay for follow-up care that's provided in a community or residential or outpatient setting. You know, that's more cost-effective rather than in a hospital or an emergency room. Section 8 of the bill deals with the critical access provider rates, and I talked a little bit about those and why they're so important for especially safety net providers. And this language, it just maintains that those payment rates and the payment rates that community health centers receive continue under Minnesota Care and a new basic health program. And I might have skipped a section. I'm sorry. Section 6. Keeping track of what's still here. another really important and measure for safety net providers, in order for them to provide cost-effective and efficient care, is to look at the Medicaid reimbursement for providing medical and mental health encounters on the same day. Under current MA policy, providers cannot receive reimbursement for two encounters on the same day if one is for a medical service and one is for a behavioral health service. And just for example, we have a community health center who just recently told me the story of a patient who had been in to see their primary care doctor, and in the course of the visit, the doctor discovered that the patient was smoking again. Through the further discussion, found out that the patient's brother had died, and the patient was depressed and using smoking as a coping mechanism. That provider was able to walk that patient down the hall to set up a behavioral health visit, but under the current policy to address the depression, they would not be able to be paid for that behavioral health visit because it occurred on the same day. So this bill changes the payment policy for Minnesota healthcare programs to allow payment for providers on both a medical and mental health encounter on the same day. And I believe there is a fiscal note on this from the House version of this bill. So I think that addresses all of the provisions we have left in
section,
our...
Section 13 as well.
Oh, Section 13.
The FQHC.
Thank you.
Subsidy.
Yes, that is proposing an increase into the existing community health center grants for primary care. And for those community clinics who serve large numbers of uninsured, this helps them continue to serve the uninsured, as well as invest in things like expanding oral health care, providing behavioral health care, investing in the health information technology, the things that they need in order to provide efficient and cost-effective care for their patients.
Okay. With that, we do have a fiscal note here that's drafted to the language in Section 6 that covered from a House provision. It's just two copies.
15 being taken out?
15's out. Or 14. I didn't have a 15. Is there 15 in the bill?
Might have been an appropriation at the end for everything.
No, I don't have the bill in front of me.
Oh, there's 16. There's a health disparities payment enhancement. That was actually Section 15 that we deleted, I guess. Huh. There was a Section 14 is a Merck costs. That is the that we've already heard, and we deleted. I guess this handout is quite in sync with the bill. Critical access mental health rates. Section 1.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm trying to figure out the same thing. Is 15 and 16 still in the bill, or are they being taken out?
15 was supposed to be out.
Okay.
But the motion evidently was improper because the motion was made off of the handout, but it was the intent to, you know, maybe we should reconsider, maybe Senator Hayden moves, we reconsider the vote by which his oral amendment to strike provisions was adopted, and let's get that back before us and try to get the right.
Yep, let's do that, Mr. Chair.
Motion. So we're going to, Senator Hayden is going to move section, the removal of section 2, which is health disparities. Actually, that's where the problem came in, was right there. Section 2 is not health disparities. Section 3 is health disparities. There's a section 2.
Right.
This is...
Let's not work off of the... This is wrong.
Yeah, we're going to need to... Oh, in order to
Mr. Chair, I figured it out. There was an amendment before we knew we had to kind of do all of this work. There was an author's amendment I was going to put in that would have rearranged, and we're working off of what the A1 amendment we thought we had to put in, and that's where we're going wrong. So.
Well, and in order to reconsider the motion, we do need to vote on whether or not we reconsider that motion. On the motion to reconsider, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Okay, now we have the bill back before us, and you have an amendment.
Well, I don't think we need the amendment now, but when we thought we were going to hear the whole bill, I had an author's amendment, and this was drafted to it. Mr. Chair, I think that we are going to move that we delete section 3.
Two.
So section 2.
Three.
Section 3.
Section 4.
Section 4. 5.
Keeping 6.
Okay, let's talk about this.
7.
7.
9. 10.
10.
11.
11.
12.
14.
15.
And 15.
Okay. Let me make a list. We're going to keep section 1, 6, 8, 13, and 16 if we adopt this motion. So that is the same number we intended to, number of sections we intended to keep when we adopted the last motion. So I'm just going to use that and say Senator Hayden moves to strike sections 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 9, 10, 11, 12, 14, and 15. On that motion, any discussion? Seeing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Okay, and then we described each of the sections that we retained already. So on those sections that remain, and Senator Brown, Senator 14 and 15 that you asked about are indeed gone from the bill.
16's gone.
16 is still in there.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment that I'd like to offer. And I'm wondering if now is the appropriate time.
Sure.
Okay, I'd like to offer, Mr. Chair, members, the A7 amendment. And Mr. Godfrey from HMC will explain the amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is David Godfrey. I'm here representing Hennepin County Medical Center and Hennepin County. The amendment before you creates a new supplemental Medicaid payment to support Hennepin County's county-owned and operated ambulance system. The non-federal share, unlike most Medicaid payments, is paid for by the county through an intergovernmental transfer of funds. And you may have heard of the term IGT. This is another IGT, of which we have 5 or 6 currently in statute. There's no cost to the state for the Medicaid payment because we are picking up that non-federal share. The state essentially acts as a pass-through agent, which enables the Medicaid payment to be made with the feds. In the past 10 years, about 8 different IGT proposals that did not impact general fund spending, and in none of those cases was a fiscal note requested or required And so we believe that this is cost neutral and that you could adopt it today, and there would be no cost to the state. We're essentially financing our own Medicaid payment so we can better support our ambulance system. And Mr. Chair, can I just add one more thing?
Mr. Godfrey.
These IGT payments have been around since the inception of the Medicaid program to enable counties and other local units of government to support their publicly owned healthcare providers.
Yep.
And so I just wanted to make that's why this is somewhat unique and why Hennepin County and also Ramsey County through Regents Hospital are able to provide the support to their hospitals.
And is somebody from DHS here to confirm that there would be no fiscal cost associated with this were we to adopt it today? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Giogo Hayes, Department of Human Services. Mr. Godfrey did point this amendment out to us this morning. Unfortunately, we haven't had the appropriate staff look at it, so I can't confirm or deny that there is or is not a cost to it at the time. But we can have staff look at it and get back to you as soon as we can.
Okay. Any estimate of how long it will take you to determine whether or not there would be a cost to this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can, as soon as possible, I can get back to you. I know we're working on some other fiscal
well,
too.
Mr. Chair. If the assertion is that there is no cost, and if there is, you know, I mean, we would need to consider it. If the assertion is, and you're fairly comfortable that there is no cost, I'd be more comfortable not adopting it, not having that confirmation, but it would be still a proper amendment when we bring the delete everything forward. And by that time, we would have some certainty from the department as to whether or not there was costs. I'm uncomfortable adopting amendments not having any confirmation that there is no cost.
If that's the chair's question, we were wondering if Mr. Albrecht wanted to had any opinion on this, and I don't want to put him on the spot. And if he goes like this, I won't ask him, but I was just wondering if that can help along. Otherwise, we could do it later, Mr. Chair. I was just trying to.
Mr. Albrecht?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, my understanding is the same as Mr. Godfrey's with respect to these provisions, in that in the past they have been put forth without fiscal notes and do not represent a cost to the general fund.
Okay. Well, that helps a great deal. I guess maybe I'd be comfortable adopting the amendment if this is the procedure that it's gone through in the past, and if we find out otherwise, we will know by the time we adopt, we pick up, delete everything to carry forward. So with that, Senator Hayden moves the A7 amendment. Any further conversation? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Hayden's A7, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. On the balance of the provisions, I do see there's an empty appropriation in Section 16, Senator Hayden. Did you have numbers to plug into those for our?
Have a number?
Senator Chair, Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know that we did a lot of work on this on the fly, a little impromptu, so I'm not sure. I'm kind of looking for a lifeline here to figure out if we've developed the number for the appropriation.
Article, there's Section 16. Did you have appropriations that they were going to fill in? There's a blank appropriation. I just need to fill it. That's all.
Just Section 16 out.
Staff says that we don't really need Section 16 for the rest of the purposes left in the bill. Is that?
That's fine with me, Mr. Chief. That's what our great staff is recommending.
Delete Section 16 as well. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. On the balance of the bill, Any further questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 1099? Seeing Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question on Section 13. That's a $10 million biennial expansion appropriation to FQHC. So how would this money be spent? It's a
Which
lot
section
of money.
Is that, Senator
section
Kiffmeyer?
Section 13. I think it is one that's not deleted.
Section 13 is one that's not deleted. $5 million per year for the FQHCs.
Well, Mr. Chair, it looks like we have some help with that.
Mr. Chair, my name is Rhonda Degelo. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. And the community health centers have been receiving an annual appropriation of $2,250,000 per year to continue expand and improve services to low-income populations. The community health centers currently use these funds to offset $39 million worth of care to 70,000 uninsured patients. A portion of the state appropriation is used to offset that uncompensated care after taking into account other sources of revenue to compensate to pay for the uncompensated care, such as federal and local grants, private foundation funding, and patient contributions to their care. Once all is said and done, of that $39 million in uncompensated care, we still have a $6 million gap that we're trying to close. So part of this new funding would go toward closing that gap. But in addition to that, the health centers looked at this legislative proposal and what they would be able to do with some additional funding and highlighted the following items for expansion of oral health services for low-income populations, hiring additional staff and equipment, expanding mobile dental care services in southern Minnesota, immediate hiring of behavioral health staff, hiring of care coordination workers and community health workers to better coordinate care, investment in information technology, practice redesign investment to achieve healthcare home certification, and working toward preventing unnecessary ER visits by enhanced care coordination.
Ms. Delgado, this testimony sounds familiar. Didn't we already adopt this, lay this very same provision on the table once before?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Assume this is already on the table. And
right, Mr. Chair, that's why I wanted to ask the question, because it was just in case.
I'm not going to pick it up
I've
twice.
I've heard this before. Right. Yes.
Okay.
It's a big money. It's a big money.
Yes. All right. Any other questions of members?
Does that mean we delete Section 13 from this then?
Section 13, we can certainly delete it. It's already on the table for our consideration and possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So, Senator Hayden, are you...
If that's the committee's pleasure, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden moves to delete Section 13 as well. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, I just have one more thing. It's a little out of the ordinary, but there was a study on the emergency medical assistance that DHS was going to provide, and I spoke to them. I'm not sure if they have that, but I'd like for them to come up and at least talk about if they have the study or what the progress of the study is. I think that that's important as part of this provision.
Welcome back to the committee. Do you have any insights into that EMA study and when it might be available?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity. The EMA study is very near completion. We had several stakeholder meetings to get their input into the study as well. It's currently going through the very last stages of final approval through the administration, and we should have it out very shortly.
When was this supposed to be completed?
I apologize, Mr. Chair. I don't have the date with me at the moment.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if my recollection, and this could be totally wrong, but I thought it was January 15th. I just pulled that out of nowhere, somewhere there. So, so I thought January 15th is when it was supposed to be due. That, which is why I wanted to bring it up. We're pretty concerned, and this is a kind of a really big deal. And so we want to not chastise the department, but really kind of put on the record that we're anxiously waiting this this report.
Yes, and you know, I am hoping that in the bills that we pass, the Health and Human Services bills that we pass this year, we can find a better resolution to the EMA issue that's plagued us for a couple of years now than we have on the books today. And so that we anxiously await that study that came from the stakeholder process. So make sure you get that to us as soon as possible. Sure. With that, any other questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 1099, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senate File 777, Senator Hayden, are you?
Yes, sir, I'm ready. My file, I think.
Yep. Sure, it's not up there at the table under.
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, is it? Oh, yeah, maybe it is. I don't really quite know where I'm at either, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While they're setting up, I just wanted to make a comment because I've seen the FQHCs and language in a variety of places here, and one of them actually is in this bill also on Section 8 and allowing them to have critical access payments, which would increase their revenues. So sometimes there is a specific appropriation. Other times we've also increased their payment rate. So just to be sure that when all is said and done, that we include all sources maybe. So
okay.
Their work's important, but so is other work. And yep. Just to think of that. Thank you.
Thank you for the point, Senator Kiffmeyer. That was on Senate File 1099 before we move on. Senate File 777, Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We have Senate File 777. I like to say that. I'll say it again, 777. This is brought to me by the Association of Minnesota Counties. It's been a considerable amount of work, as you know, Mr. Chair, on this bill. I'm not going to belabor the intro. I'm going to give it over to Ms. Ring from the Association of Minnesota Counties to explain the bill and to move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Julie Ring, and I'm the Health and Human Services Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I will also be very brief. I know some of you have already heard about this bill. I'll give you a really quick intro, and then if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. So Senate File 777 is one of the Association of Minnesota Counties' top priorities for this session across all areas of county government, not just Health and Human Services. This is part of our property tax relief package that we brought to the Capitol this year because this bill is going to allow us to draw down some federal funding to cover some costs that are paid out of county property tax dollars at this time. This bill was rated as a priority for all urban, suburban, and rural counties across the state this year. So in essence, currently, counties pay all the cost of health care for any inmate in any of our jails. There's no state reimbursement or federal reimbursement for any of those costs. And as you might imagine, the health care costs of those jail inmates have been increasing significantly over the last few years for chronic illnesses, for mental illnesses, and communicable diseases. The bill, as it's written, would allow counties, as well as the state prison system, to draw down federal medical assistance reimbursement for a portion of these costs, for the inpatient hospitalization costs. It's the only cost that is allowable by the feds. And while that is only a portion of the costs, it is a very expensive and a highly unpredictable cost for us and for the state prison system. And so, in summary, I know you have a fiscal note on the bill. The fiscal note gives you, a nice overview of the cost savings to the state and counties, which is estimated at about $10 million by passing this bill. We're expecting with MA expansion and with regular MA that on average we're going to have the feds paying for approximately on average 85% of these costs that have to this point been paid out of county property taxes and for the prisons out of the state general fund budget. So we think this is a good bill. It's a win-win for the state budget and for county budgets. And even better yet, the way the financing works through the Department of Corrections savings, it is cost neutral to you in Health and Human Services. With that, I will stop and answer any questions you might have.
Mrs. Ring, I appreciate this effort and have been glad to work on it a little bit myself. We've been pursuing this for several years now. The feds
probably almost a decade.
Just about. The feds did finally allow for this MA coverage to flow to an individual that is in the custody of a public entity when they're on the outside of the facilities and inpatient settings. And I tell you what really helps is the Medicaid expansion, so that approximately two-thirds of these individuals will be on that expansion group and covered at 100% of the cost by the Fed. So I'm very glad we did finally work through all of the issues associated with this and believe we have a workable package at long last, and I'm very happy to see that. Any other questions? Any questions of members? Seeing none. Senator Hayden, any additional testimony?
No, it's a great bill, Mr. Chair, and thank you for all your work.
You're welcome. Anyone from the audience care to testify either in support or opposition? Senator Hayden and Ms. Krenke, it's nice to see you guys sitting next to each other again.
Yeah, it's a little deja vu, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I just want to go. My name is Mary Krenke, and just for the record, I want to thank the Association of Counties for adding the language regarding the security of the patient. This is very important to the hospitals because you are allowed to leave a hospital at any time. You do not have to get care. So it was very important that that language regarding the security of the patient remains with the government entity. So just very thankful that that language was included. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Anyone else from the audience care to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 7777? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 777 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Senator
Mr. Chairman.
Hayden.
Thank you.
Supposed to stay with us, wasn't it?
Yeah, it goes around.
Okay. Senator Sharon, are you ready for Senate File 1318?
You can be thankful you didn't get Senator Eaton's number 666.
Oh, yeah, I really didn't want to get that. Oh, my God.
That bill didn't do so well.
Yeah, I don't think so.
That's funny.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Senator Laurie, will we be taking all of my bills at this time, or will you want to take a break between the first two, or is there an order
well,
here?
As I announced earlier, there's members not on this committee who will be coming and going. We have several committees operating concurrently. I know that Senator Ortman is hoping to get in here soon. Okay. If you need a break, we have other members as well. But we'll start with 318 and see if others come that need to be inserted into
great.
The agenda.
Okay, the first, then, is Senate File 1318. This is a bonding request. So we're shifting now to the request that the committees have, finance committees have had to review bonding requests. This particular request has been in front of the legislature before. It is a request for the Regional Treatment Center in St. Peter. We have for you some handouts so that you're able to see a little more clearly what the request is about and what it attempts to accomplish. So if those would be handed out, it gives you a vision of the campus and names the buildings that will be implemented, will be affected by these various changes. And with that, if those handouts are out and people have a visual, I don't think you can understand what we're doing without that. Well, that's a description, but is there a... Has this got a pictures?
It has the pictures.
Okay, so we can begin. and I will have the department. I also have an amendment. Excuse me, Senator Lori. The language in the bill as presented is different than the language in the governor's bill. So we are asking, this is the first time the bill has been heard, so it can be an author's amendment, yep, to align the language of the bonding request with the governor's language.
Okay, Senator.
And that's the A2 amendment.
Senator Sharon moves the A2 author's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Okay.
Senator Sharon, and then you're going to...
Please introduce
yourself. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I'm Chuck Johnson with the Department of Human Services. Thanks for the opportunity to come here, and thank you to Senator Sharon for sponsoring this bill. This is the St. Peter bonding proposal. This is the proposal the governor put forward last year. It was not funded. We did get some money to do some pre-design and design work, which we have done. So the proposal is a little bit different this year than what we talked about last year. And it is part of the governor's priorities for bonding for this year as well. This is really a comprehensive plan for the St. Peter campus. For those of you that are aware, the St. Peter campus has essentially two programs on it. The security hospital, which provides forensic services for people that are committed to the department as mentally ill and dangerous. And then the Minnesota sex offender program has its later stages of treatment on the St. Peter campus. Folks are familiar with the Moose Lake facility. That's the earlier stages of MSOP treatment, but the sex offender program has later stages of treatment in St. Peter on the lower campus. This is a very large and complex proposal, and it's a multi-phase proposal. We're going to be doing some construction, some demolition, some remodeling over the course of a couple of phases. And the request is for $51.1 million this year for bonding, so it's a significant size proposal as well. There's three overarching objectives to this proposal. The first is to update and upgrade the facility, the security hospital that serves people who are mentally ill and dangerous. This is both to improve the facility for purposes of safety for staff and for our patients. It's also to improve the treatment environment, including creating the right places of treatment and separation of treatment for people that are in different stages of their treatment cycle. Second objective is to separate the populations that are currently blended on the lower campus of St. Peter in the sex offender program and the security hospital population. And the third objective is to use some of the older buildings on the lower part of the campus to provide us with some additional beds for the sex offender program going forward. Mr. Chair, if you look at slide 4 or page 4 in the slides, that lays out the dollar numbers that are associated with this bonding request. You can see for this 2013 request, $46.8 million is being requested for the security hospital program, and $4.35 million is being requested for the Minnesota sex offender program. Mr. Chair, if you turn to page 6, it really gives you a oversight of what the campus looks like in St. Peter. And I think that this is a good place for those that aren't as familiar with the layout of the campus to kind of understand how things are set up right now. The big blue building that's kind of toward the upper left there of the graphic, that's the security hospital. That's where it sits right now. For those who haven't been to the campus, there is a... The Minnesota River Bluff runs right through the campus. So that blue building is on the top of the bluff. The other collection of buildings you see down to the lower right, those are on the lower part of the bluff, and there's a real physical separation between those two parts of the campus. All the buildings that are shown here in blue are currently housing or being used for the purpose of the security hospital program. So the big security hospital building on top of the hill, plus a number of the buildings that are on the lower part of the campus. In addition, you'll see the buildings in red, and those are buildings that are currently housing people within the sex offender program. Our ultimate goal with this project over the three phases is to get all of the security hospital patients and facilities and services moved to the top of the hill and leave the sex offender program on the bottom of the hill to renovate those older buildings with some shared buildings for administrative purposes and so forth that would also continue to stay on the lower part of the campus. Mr. Chair, if you like text, you can look at pages 7 and 8. If you like a graphic, you can look at page 9. So it kind of gets at the same thing, which explains a little bit about what we're going to be doing with the security hospital portion of this proposal. There's a number of things we're trying to accomplish in phase one of this proposal, which I really focused on trying to help the most acute patients that we have within the system. In addition, it's important in phase one that we build additional beds that allow us to do all the moving around of patients we'll need to do as we get into phase two. This is the kind of a proposal we're going to have to move people around as we're renovating certain parts of a building, move them into the new piece, and then renovate the old piece and so forth, and we need to have the capacity to do that. The pieces that we're building in the first phase include a 4-bed evaluation unit and a 12-bed crisis unit. The evaluation unit is really where folks would come in, people who have been committed to us would come into when they first come into the system and allow us to do that evaluation, assess them, understand where they are, what kind of treatment they need. We don't have that right now, and keeping those patients separate from the general population is terribly important. Additional 12-bed crisis unit, similarly, we don't have a crisis unit right now. It's really important when a patient does go into crisis that we're able to separate them from the general population. They can often affect the treatment progress of people who aren't in crisis just by having the person in crisis within that population. It also builds a new 40-unit housing for acute patients, a 24-bed transition unit. Right now, the transition beds for those that are transitioning out and are in later stages of treatment, we're moving, trying to move back toward the community, are on the lower part, lower campus at St. Peter. Again, we want to move those up to the upper campus. And if you're looking at the graphic, you can see sort of on the left, there's this building that has kind of shaped like an E with an extra thing in it. And the blue part is the part we'd build in phase one, and then the red part is the part that we built in phase two. Although we'd assess the number of beds in between to see if we really need all 72 of those or how we play that out in phase two. We'd also build in phase one a new social center, vocational building, and central plant. You can see on the graphic, all those new pieces are shown in kind of this grayish blue color. And then phase two new construction is shown in red. But a lot of what happens in phase two, and this would be a 2014 request, is really the remodeling and renovation of the existing building itself. By building the new pieces first, we're able to have some capacity to move people around so we can then move in second phase and start doing the renovation of the existing building. The existing building, Mr. Chair, if you turn to page 10, you can get a picture of what the building looks like now on the inside and what the living units look like that our patients are living in. It's kind of a cross between a treatment center and a prison in the way that it appears, and for those of you who visited have certainly felt this. A number of narrow stairways and narrow hallways, blind corners, and this split level, which really creates problems for poor sight lines for our staff, security staff, and nurses and so forth, as well as for patients who are in a living unit and not knowing what they'll see when they go around the corner. So it's not really an environment that matches the current kind of treatment environment we want for folks who are trying to get in a position when they can move back to the community. The next two slides show you what a modern, secure treatment environment should look like. The first one on slide 11 is the Anoka Regional Treatment Center, which obviously we operate in DHS, DHS facility. The wide hallways, well lit, good sight lines from the nurse's station to be able to see the patient living quarters, as well as being able to see the activity areas where patients congregate for various activities and meals and so forth. Slide 12 is similar. This is a facility some of our staff visited in South Dakota, a Nevera facility. Again, a new building or a new facility, a secure treatment environment. Again, you can see how open this is compared to what we have right now in the security hospital in St. Peter. Again, providing good sight lines, well lit, an ability to sort of see what's going on and for people to feel comfortable in the environment. Slide 13 shows you a little closer up schematic of what the lower campus currently looks like at the St. Peter and St. Peter campus. And you can see the two buildings that are circled in red here, Bartlett and Johnson. Those buildings are currently used for transitional housing for folks in the security hospital program. In between them physically are the blue buildings, which is where the sex offender population is being housed. And this really creates problems because the folks in now the folks in the buildings that are within that pink line in the security in the sex offender program, they're within a secure perimeter. But the blue Green Acres building over here are actually the sex offender patients who do have the ability to move around campus. They're in late stage of treatment, as well as the people in the red buildings who are in the security hospital program who also have the ability to move around campus. And we have those populations mixing right now. The people who are committed to us for mental illness are vulnerable adults under law. People are committed to us as sex offenders are predators under law. It's not really a good idea to have these populations mixing together on a daily basis when they have campus privileges. And that's why we really want to move what's now in the red up to the upper part of the campus. Mr. Chair, I'm not going to go through the bed summaries that are on the next slides. The point within the security hospital is really not a not to add beds. It's really to improve the treatment environment for our patients. That's not a bed-related, increasing bed-related proposal. I'll just summarize then for you on page 17 what we're proposed to do in phase one with the sex offender program so you can get sort of both pieces of the proposal. This proposal is for $4.3 million. $1.72 of that would be used for pre-planning and pre-design and design work related to the next phases for the sex offender program. $2.63 million of it would be to remodel and refurbish the west wing of the Green Acres building. Green Acres is one of the buildings on the lower campus. It's currently used by the sex offender program. This would be to build more capacity for our community placement services. That is the last stage treatment for the sex offender program. That's where we believe we need to have more capacity in the short term. We'd like to be able to get started on that right away. In the end, through all three phases, as is currently laid out within the piece of the program that relates to the sex offender program, we would have the capacity to add 200 beds to the lower campus of St. Peter. We have played this proposal out for the sex offender program over three bonding cycles. That gives us the opportunity to reassess the need for beds as we're going forward. We all know that there are bills, including, of course, the one that Senator Sharon is carrying, to look at different ways to address the sex offender population going forward. We want to have flexibility in how we're adding or not adding beds so that we're not overbuilding capacity we may not need. On the other hand, right now we're sitting looking at about 120 patients that will come to us next biennium out of the correction system and into the sex offender program, and we need to make sure that we're building the capacity for that population as we go forward. Mr. Chair, with that, I think I'll stop and take any questions the committee has or review anything I went through too fast for anyone to track it.
Any questions of members? Seeing none. Senator Sharon? Any further comments? I need to open it up to the public.
No, I just want to confirm that this is very important investment. It's a state facility that covers and serves the entire state of Minnesota.
Yep.
And it you already saw the state operated services auditor's report to talk about some of the significant problems that are occurring in parts of these facilities. This is one of the remedies that needs to be in place to lower those difficulties that they're having in the security hospital.
Okay. Anyone in the audience care to speak either in support or opposition to Senate File 1318? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. I just want to speak in favor of this bill. People are committed to the St. Peter Security Hospital an average of 8 years. They deserve to be treated in an environment that is actually therapeutic, not only the surroundings, but also the care that's provided there. And I think it's very difficult to do that in their current surroundings. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else from the audience who would like to speak either in support or opposition to Senate File 1318? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 1318 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the letter that goes to the Capital Investments Committee for recommendation for inclusion in the bonding in a potential bonding bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Sharon. On bonding bills, you know, last night I was wandering around the Capitol, wound up watching on the judiciary for a little while and saw them passing around a form for members to indicate their preferences. And so I thought that was a good idea. I wasn't quite clear how we would. There was many questions about how we would proceed with the bonding requests, and we've heard as a committee, I don't know, maybe five of these. I think there's a couple more to go, but once we have a complete list of all of the bonding proposals that are going to come before us, we will compile a list of those and, the Senate file numbers so that members can go look at them and ask members to rank their priorities from the committee, and we'll use that to structure our letter to the Capital Investment Committee, just as a heads-up process-wise for how we're going to proceed with that. Has Senator Ortman made it here yet? I thought I saw her, but maybe not. Senator Sharon, are you prepared for
Yes, we'll begin with the next one. I think this will be pretty brief. Mr. Tennyson, would you like to join me? This is Senate File 347, the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. Just as a brief explanation, this provision creates language in the state of Minnesota to comply with changes that are recommended at the federal level for assisting states to have a uniform interstate support act that allows states to make a lot of determinations when the child support process crosses geographic boundaries. In the past, most of the language that we've had in place and at the federal level have related to activities within the in the confines of the United States. The states have been supportive of working with other countries in terms of helping those persons in other countries who are trying to collect child support payments from persons who come to the United States. This extends and adds activity with participating countries for the United States to be able to have persons collect child support payments when persons move to those countries. The importance of us passing this uniform law is that that once the law is ratified at the federal level, there will be a short time frame in which the states can come into compliance with it or risk the federal supports that are given to the state for child support collection. So that's a very 50,000-foot level. We've had hearings on this in policy. On the fiscal impact, you can see on the front page that there is nothing showing, but I also, in the detail of the note, would be remiss if I did not point out to you, Senator Lori, that there is language that explains the absence of a fiscal note related to the fact that the actual provisions that need to be passed at the federal level are not yet passed. So there may be costs associated with this in the range of $50,000 once this is ratified at the federal level. I have Mr. Tennyson with me, who may want to make a few comments or answer any specific questions you may have.
Mr. Tennyson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll just respond to questions if it...
I actually hadn't caught that line where the potential $50,000 of state costs was. Why? In what sense is it potential? I'm just flipping through this now. Do you, Mr. Tennyson, Senator Sharon, know under what circumstances those would?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I couldn't hear you.
I could probably answer the question. If you note on page 3 of the fiscal note that there is there's one-time legal policy analysis and document changes, as well as programming costs in the prison child support system. I think that's where they are accumulating some of the costs and identifying which of those costs would be associated with the state's share. It's a one-time cost.
Okay. But as to why then it doesn't roll up onto the... I mean, they must just be agreeing to absorb these costs as...
I would love to say I'm absolutely certain that that's true.
Well, I mean,
but I can't.
You know what? This absolutely blank front page gives me a lot of comfort.
Okay.
That's what we're going to, we would track on our sheet. We just did some quick research to find out where this is in the House. It is stuck in the Finance Committee of the House, which means that they, according to their current interpretation of their deadlines, they wouldn't be able to move it on, so it would need to be carried in their omnibus bill. So we'll do the dual track thing. Perfect. In case they change their mind and decide that they can release some bills to the floor that have no cost like this. That would be my intention, I guess. Any other question of members? Seeing none, anyone from the audience care to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 347? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 347 be recommended to pass and both referred to the Committee on Finance and laid on the table here for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Sharon.
I can continue unless there's someone else that you'd like to move in here now, Senator Lori.
I think we can take up your next one.
Yeah, this is Senate File 582, Maternal Depression Bill that has been heard in health policy.
Go ahead, Senator Sharon. Do you have an amendment?
Thank you, Senator Lori. This is a bill that is attempting to deal with a significant problem that we've all heard about. You just recently we heard the doula bill in which there was a discussion about maternal depression and the incidence and the frequency of this. We aren't intending today to describe to you or to persuade you that the problem exists, because that's testimony has already been given and affirmed in the policy committee. What we want to do today, I think, because of the focus of this committee, is to identify what the fiscal note will be supporting and what those projects will try to accomplish. If that's okay with you. If people want us to talk about why this is necessary, we will, but I'm assuming that the committee accepts that the policy committee has already evaluated that, recognizes the need, would like to see the finance committee to find a way to support this. So today we're going to talk about what the fiscal note is and what it accomplishes, unless you'd ask for something else, Senator Lori.
No, we can stick to the fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, and I've been asked to briefly explain what this bill does. And what it does, the most important piece is that it applies a two-generational approach to maternal depression in making certain that moms are being identified as early as possible, that they are either at risk or that they're already experiencing maternal depression, and then getting the services to them that they need. And that second part of the two-generational approach is to make certain that babies, that the young children that they are raising, that they also have access to the services that they need in the event that they are already exhibiting potential harm from the effects of maternal depression.
Senator Sharon?
More specifically, what this does is increases the amount of time that a woman postpartum is able to receive support services, recognizing that the issues of anxiety and depression postpartum extend for a longer period of time, and also allows for some supports for children who are now supported for a year to a 24-month period of time. Those are the major portions of the bill that have the biggest fiscal note associated with them. There are other portions of the bill related to education and training that are equivalently important in terms of identifying and referring and early intervention into the problem of maternal depression.
Senator Sharon, do you have an amendment?
And I have an amendment. It's the A3 amendment.
But does this have an effect on the financing of it, or is it a... Yes, it does.
But this is included in the fiscal note.
So the fiscal note is... Yes, the fiscal note is drafted to the A3 amendment, it appears, from reading it. Okay. So... this the first hearing? No, we had a hearing in policy.
Yes.
We already covered that. But so you've described it essentially with the A3 amendment and as the fiscal note is drafted to. So with that, any questions on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you. Just to explain, in the original bill, we included the Department of Education, and that created some confusion for them in terms of trying to provide their portion of the fiscal note. So we removed that. That's what the amendment does.
Okay. I see they're not included on the fiscal note, so that worked. On the bill, any further questions of members? Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question about, do insurance carriers outside of public assistance cover these types of needs?
Senator Sharon, Ms. Fitzsimmons?
Mr. Chair, Senator Clausen, I cannot answer that question, but there may be somebody here who can.
And Senator Laurie, Senator Clausen, I can't for certain indicate, because I think it depends on the policy and whether or not provisions for mental health services are adequately covered. And as you know, there's lots of variations on that theme in people's individual health policies.
Mr. Chair.
Actually, I think Ms. Abderholden might be the best resource here to articulate that.
Ms. Abderholden, welcome back to the committee. State your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. Many plans in Minnesota do cover some of the mental health services. Some actually do cover ARM services, adult rehab mental health services, but not all, and not all of the different things that are in the bill. But they do cover ARMs, although I will just point out that the addition of child development under ARMs is new, but that also, in my reading of the fiscal note, had no increased cost to it. So just kind of want to highlight that little section, too.
Just to be clear about what that just meant, is there is a language, I'm trying to pull it up very quickly, that adds what ARMS can do right now under the language for what is allowable activity under ARMS for reimbursement does not include something that we're adding here. And I'm just looking quickly for the language it relates to being able to train to... Yeah, it adds as allowable reimbursement time spent with the family to teach parenting skills.
Okay. These appropriations in Article 3 are intended to provide the money to cover the items covered here. One approach, rather than trying to plug these numbers in at this time. Maybe you have numbers to plug the blank appropriations. If not, we could delete Article 3, and if we picked up any of these provisions, we would track it in the spreadsheet appropriately. Senator Sharon,
I'd agree
to delete Article 3. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Any further questions of members? Seeing none.
Senator Laurie, I just would conclude by saying, this has a big fiscal note. I know that we're really going to struggle when it comes up here after the weekend to look at what we're going to be able to pay for. And we are we really believe this is important. Area of mental health services. Many mental health services have been in front of you this year to find a way to address this critical mental health issue. But we also are willing to work with you to try to figure out what the priorities might be if we need to have those conversations. We hope that that will be a part of what we do as we move forward here.
Thank you for that. Anyone else from the audience care to speak either in support or opposition to Senate File 582? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 582, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Sharon. We have Senator Ortman here, I see, for Senate File 647.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. It has been, I think, only once before that I've been before the Health and Human Services Committee, and this is a very big topic and one that I enter into at my own peril. I know. I think once you get in, you don't dabble in health and human services, I guess is what I'm saying. And because I'm here at my peril, I brought the Sheriff's Association with me. Jim Franklin from the Sheriff's Association is with me to testify today if you have any questions about the bill that's being presented. But Senate File 647 has passed through the Judiciary Committee. What it does is it addresses inmates in our jails across the state of Minnesota. I learned that there were delays for some of our inmates in getting the adequate care and treatment that they are deserving under court order. So what this bill does is just sets a timeline that says that if one of our courts, a judge, orders restoration treatment or commitment care and treatment, that the commissioner of the Department of Human Services who receives the custody of that person or is ordered to provide treatment must do so within 48 hours. And I am pleased to say that the Department of Human Services has been very helpful, proposed the language that you see in front of you that creates a little bit of flexibility about the level of security that would be provided. But with that, they've also provided a zero fiscal note. We're not asking DHS to care for any more of the patients, and we're not asking them to provide longer care. We're just asking them to make sure that that care is provided within 48 hours, that they don't languish in our jail. These folks are innocent until proven guilty. They are pre-adjudication in many cases, and they deserve care and treatment immediately. So I would appreciate your support. I know it also has the support of the National Alliance of Mentally Ill, the Sheriff's Association, the Public Defenders, and, of course, your Judiciary Committee.
Okay, and just for members, we had Senate File 647, the first engrossment in our packets, and the language that we're taking up that the new fiscal note has been drafted to is actually the committee report coming out of Judiciary Finance Committee.
That's
because
correct.
Because we're still within the broader Finance Committee here. And so we have on 8.5 by 11 the language that we're actually taking up that that had this new fiscal note that brought it to zero, and I know Senator Ortman has put in a great deal of work on this. So if members are trying to understand it, that's where to go to look. Any questions of members? Seeing none, any further testimonies, Senator Ortman? Anybody here to offer testimony?
Mr. Chair, it's Friday afternoon. I understand what's going on in this committee because it just happened in the Tax Committee. But I would ask that if you would, if the committee would include it in an omnibus bill but also send it as a standalone bill. I think with a zero fiscal note, we can pass this off the Senate floor, and that would be my preference, but I would appreciate the treatment for both.
You and I talked about dual tracking this one, and we're getting fairly comfortable with that process. The House has an interpretation of their timelines where if bills weren't actually out of finance committees by the second deadline that we consider policy deadlines, they can't ever get out of finance committee. So the third deadline only applied to the omnibus bills. Finance committees in the House are not allowed to pass anything other than the omnibus bills out. And so anything stuck in finance stays there, and that's why we're trying to keep things on the table that may or may not be able to get moving again in the House. But with that, anyone from the audience care to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 647? Seeing none, Senator Brown moves that Senate File 647, the committee report from the Committee on Finance, be recommended to pass and dual-tracked, that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the full Committee on Finance, and that it be laid on the table in Health and Human Services for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, on Senator Brown's motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you,
Senator. Thank you, members. Have a good weekend.
You too. Okay. Senator Claussen, your bill is not ready, I understand, or is it? Are you ready?
Should be.
Is the fiscal note ready? 1 second, Senator Claussen. We need, Senator Claussen, before you head to the table, we need to make sure that your fiscal note is ready. I don't know. Have you seen it? Do you know that the final fiscal note is ready or not?
Mr. Chair, I was under the impression that there is no cost involved to this, so that's why.
We would need DHS to confirm that, and if they're not prepared to do so, probably be best not to take it up yet.
Well, this was heard in policy, and at that time I thought we had taken care of this, but apparently not, Mr. Chair, so we will have to delay, apparently.
Okay, I mean, is there... Okay, maybe we'll move on to my bills. I think that's all that's left on the agenda. And Senator Claussen, maybe you want to walk around a little bit, talk to DHS, work with Senate fiscal staff here, and see if you can figure that out. If we're able to accommodate you, we're happy to do so.
We're starting with Senate File 264.
Yes, Madam Chair. Give me 2 seconds here to kind of organize. And bear with me here. I've been up there all day and things have been working on these files. But I do have Senate File 264 before you, which is it's mostly a mental health peer specialist program. See, the most recent fiscal note is handed out, I believe. We do have a couple of amendments that need to be offered, neither of which have any fiscal implications. And if you would entertain those, it could be helpful. The first is actually just an oral amendment, and it's on line. Page 4, line 24, before the period, insert "or a clinical trainee." And on page 4, line 26, after "providers," insert "and educators." We've worked with the Department of Human Services, and there's no fiscal for this. So that I would move that as an oral amendment.
Senator Lori, I got your first one. Second one?
Well, we'd have to take them up each separately.
Okay. Just to repeat them so we have...
Yes, on page 4, line 24, before the period, insert "or clinical trainee." And on page 4, line 26, after "providers," insert "and educators."
So Senator Lori moves oral amending Senate File 264. As indicated, we're going to do both changes together? I think so. Is that accurate?
Do other providers and educators? None of them.
or clinical trainee. So it's a licensed mental health professional or a clinical.
Thank you.
Are members clear with the two changes? Senator Lurie, is that the change?
Yes, that's the first, and it's an oral amendment.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails.
The second would be, it's drafted, and it's an A4 amendment.
Explain the amendment.
Yeah, this would for the covered service components of a CTSS, which is Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, we would be adding this family peer specialist, and there's no cost associated with this either.
Yeah, I've got it. Thank you.
Any questions from members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted.
So I'm going to let Ms. Abderholden step us through Senate File 264 and the fiscal implication.
Ms. Abderholden, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abderholden with NAMI, Minnesota. The first section, there should not be any fiscal note at all because we're just making it clear that third-party payer does not include a school district. They sometimes are worried right. That if they refer someone, then somehow they're responsible when they're not. The mental health certified family peer specialist, the initial cost is actually to develop the training program for this. We were able to base it on the adult peer specialist program. This is a way to help in terms of our workforce shortages, and it's also a way to help families actually feel more connected to others and not alone. And then from there on in, it would be included as part of our children's mental health providers, and that would be an additional staff person that they can bill as part of their rate. And so the fiscal note is based on how the adult mental health peer specialists expanded over several years, and so they base it on that. On page 3, the medical assistance in reach, this, of course, is also supposed to help reduce costs in the future by reducing readmissions to emergency rooms and to inpatient hospital care. But there is, of course, an upfront cost in actually providing that service. And then the family psychoeducation services and the mental health clinical care consultation were actually in the governor's budget, taking, frankly, money from another place to make sure that we could fund these two items. And I just will point out that this actually adding these two items also helps extend our schooling to mental health grants, because right now grant money is used to cover these two services, and that way it would be a part of medical assistance in Minnesota care, which then expands its insurance dollars coming in to pay for it instead. Care coordination is just a little bit different. I know there is a fiscal note associated with that as well, because that would be an additional service that could be billed for under Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports. And the last thing is the pilot provider input survey, which the department had some initial costs on in terms of developing the service, the survey rather, and then implementing it. Is that all right?
Yep.
Okay.
Questions from members? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Abderholden, you mentioned taking money from some other places to pay for this. Could you tell me what those other places would be that money came from?
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Senator, from within the Children's Mental Health Services budget. So we're kind of rearranging the deck, the chairs on the deck, so to speak, and taking them to move this in here instead, because everyone really felt that was an important piece.
Right.
Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, that was the governor's proposal. This actually, this bill doesn't actually move those around.
That's
this creates the services, and in the governor's proposal, he funded these services as well, and the mechanism he used to do it was a reallocation amongst dollars dedicated for mental health services. Yeah, no, it's good.
Any other questions from members?
Excuse Senator Sharon?
Am I understanding that this has to be subject to federal approval? This entire process is dependent on a waiver.
Ms. Edgar Holden?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, it would be an amendment to our Medicaid plan.
It is distinct from the waiver requests, though. Waiver requests are kind of a big deal. This is just a standard state plan amendment, which is a much more straightforward proposal. This is a Medicaid allowable service, and we'd be amending our state plan to let the feds know that we intend to do this. It's not the same thing as the waiver requests that we hear often. So just to make that point clear as well.
Any other questions from members? Seeing none. Senator Lurie?
Unless members of the audience wish to testify, I would move that Senate File 264, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Against, no. Motion prevails. Bill will be laid over. I believe we might.
Just keep going. Can we
wait? You ready?
Since you're there, do you want to just continue? Or?
Not really. I don't even have my fiscal note yet. I got to go get that. So this is a welcome reprieve.
Senator Clausen.
He's so funny.
Senator Clausen, on Senate File 1338.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today with you. We do have an amendment, A3, and then we will have an oral amendment to A3 based upon some tax implications that we've discovered.
And I've just been informed, Senator Clausen, we're waiting on the copy of the amendment.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't
We're
hear
just it. Waiting for a copy of the amendment to come here, but if you'd like to discuss the bill first and run, walk through it.
Sure,
members
we can do
have
that.
The bill in front of them.
Yeah. Senate File 1338 supports the efforts of a Citizen League pilot program as they work with community partners to develop a new approach to public assistance programming. And the program is called the Family Independence Demonstration Project. Some of you may recall earlier testimony to a different Senate file, FAME, Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota. And this has some similar comparable segments to it in that it tries to build assets within families that are trying to remove themselves from public assistance. Now, this is a program that's really designed for the working poor families. And it's designed to help them build a capacity for independence by encouraging them to earn and save while on public assistance programs. And what the proposal is that Citizens League would sponsor a cohort of families, perhaps 6 to 8 families. And these families would work together. They have meetings that they would come together on. They would set goals together. They would support one another. And through the community partners with the Citizens League, families would be rewarded for making gains in developing assets. For instance, to improve their health, if they would stop smoking, there might be a $25 incentive. To enroll in furthering their education, there might be a $50 reward for doing that. There might be a $50 reward if they would graduate from high school or earn equivalency from high school. So there are built-in rewards. Similar things, if they would be looking at purchasing a house, there would be a reward for that. Again, this is designed for the working poor, to try to move them off of any type of public assistance. To do that, what we're asking is that families be excluded. The asset and public assistance asset test for families participating in the program be excluded. What happens is that if they are rewarded for doing positive things, their income climbs, and then they might be taken off or excluded from certain programs. And so what we'd like to do is exclude the asset limitations so that they can work towards independence but not be penalized for doing so until they can become fully independent. So that's the gist of it. I have with me Mr. Ron Elwood representing the Citizens League, and he might want to make additional comments.
Mr. Elwood, please.
Madam Chair, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and we're actually working with the Citizens League on this initiative and supporting it. And I just want to thank Senator Clausen for bringing it forward. And the only thing I'd say is that this is exactly the kind of thing that I think we all want to support, which is to ensure that we actually don't, through our policies are all aligned to the same place, to make sure that we're not acting across purposes and actually punishing people for succeeding and moving forward and getting themselves to financial independence. So I'll be happy to answer any other questions, and thank you very much for considering this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair, I should mention also that this is a model that has been used successfully in other states. And so just to add that piece.
Thank you. Senator Sharon? Senator Rosen?
We get confused all the time.
It's a very active corner.
Mr. Elwood, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Elwood, the amendment, the A3 amendment, did take away the for a period of 3 years, and the reason for that is just ongoing. This
Mr.
is not going to be a trial.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, the purpose for that is to not necessarily hamstring the project, because it could be 3 years. But on the other hand, if it went forward beyond that, we'd have to come back to you and ask for the same thing, to disregard the $25 payment. So it seemed to be the Citizens League is in the process of developing this now and will begin implementation, so they're not exactly sure. But I know that I can tell you this, that if there was a time limit that you'd want to put on it, I don't think that they would have any problem with that at all.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Elwood, I'm just a little concerned that there is no time limit with a report back to know how this is working. Some checks and balances. That accountability measure is missing in this piece.
Mr. Elwood?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Rose, this is really not a governmental program, obviously, because this is done by the Citizens League completely outside. What the purpose of this whole thing is to simply say that the very small stipend or incentive payment of $25 shouldn't kick somebody out or eliminate their eligibility for child care assistance or anything or rental assistance payment. But again, I just want to be clear, it was just in the interest of suggesting that since they're really not sure how long this would take or how long people would be on it, but they would have absolutely, if you want to, restore the time limit, I've talked to them, and they have no problems with putting it back in.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I would be more comfortable with that, and I guess if it's not a government program, then why do we have a fiscal? No, just a little there. But also on the amendment, line 22, it's co-sponsored by a governmental or non-governmental organization. So, number one, my question is, who would that be, Mr. Elwood, and are they going to have some? Is it Citizens League going to have some checks and balances in their reaction with these organizations, whether they're non-governmental or governmental?
Mr. Elwood,
Madam Chair, and Senator Rosen, I think the reason that language was in there because at this point the Citizens League has not come to you and asked you for any financial support. I think they think maybe in a year or two, potentially, they might want to come back and ask you to you know, kick in a couple of bucks for it as well. So I think that's where the language is in there. It's a more flexible language. At this point in time, it is a completely non-governmental thing.
Well, Madam
Chair.
Rosen? Madam Chair, I guess I would be a little more comfortable at just putting a time frame in here. Oh, thank you, Ms. White.
Yep. Madam Chair,
Senator
and Senator Rosen, looking at other programs in other states, there's generally either a 2 or 3 year period that these programs would run.
Okay.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So
we have not adopted the A3 amendment and with the oral, so we might be able to accomplish
just
that
orally.
Same.
Sure. Absolutely. If it would be okay with Senator Claussen, a new paragraph D, this section expires 7/1 of 2016. 3 years. Expiration.
We could just restore the old.
Onto the A3 amendment.
Just strike the.
To be line.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Elwood.
And I don't know, I'd like to ask Ms. White, I mean, if we just remove the lines 1.2, 1.3. And restored the original language. Would that work?
Ms. White.
One point three, the amendment, and then restore the original.
Senator Friends, and while you're
Senator
trying to figure that
Sharon.
Out, I'd like to ask Senator Rosen a question, if I may. I'm just curious to know if, by setting the deadline on there. Let me start over again.
Yes.
My understanding of what's trying to be done here is that there'll be money given to somebody, this cohort of people that are working together. If they achieve certain objectives that move them towards independence, they get a small stipend. And all this is saying is that let's not count those dollars against them in terms of other public programs that they're having. This isn't going to be a huge amount of money. It's going to be some money, and you just don't want to say, hey, now we're going to count that in their income and reduce their access to other public programs because they've participated in this. They don't earn it. If they don't, it's not like it's going to be a lot of money that accumulates that we want the state to start to take away from them in order for them to be eligible for public programs. So I don't really know why we need a deadline on that. But I would love to have, and I don't know if this is what Senator Rosen would like to get at, and that's my question for you, Senator, is I'd like to hear how this goes. I'd like to have you come back in some way and say, what are you discovering with this kind of approach for achieving the goal, which is to move towards more successful asset development that will lead a person towards independence, which is what the Ladder Out of Poverty Task Force has recommended, that we do initiatives that help people move out of poverty, that we don't do things that keep them in poverty. This would help. This is a strategy to try to accomplish that. And I'd love to hear back about how it's working. But I don't think we have to discontinue it because it's not going to be that much money.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Sharon, you're exactly right. I mean, I think that's what I'm trying to get at. But I think if you – the original bill did have a deadline of 3 years on it. I believe that if you don't somehow bring them back into the legislature to explain how it is, somebody is going to show up with a expiration on that and just say, okay, we're done with this. It didn't work. So if – and I think that's a very, very valid question. Always make sure that we have some accountability measures. We want to see how successful this program – we want this program to work. So help us – help you make this program work. Yeah. Well, and that would be coming back here.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator,
and Senator Rosen and Senator Sharon, I mean, I think Senator Sharon hit the nail exactly on the head. That's exactly what this is about. And she did mention as well the task force, which is now has been renamed the Asset Development and Financial Literacy Task Force, which is just getting going again for the next biennium. And I'm sure this is the very exactly the kind of thing, Senator Rosen, that a report would be valuable and helpful. So, I'm sure the Citizens League would be delighted to tell you, everybody here, how successful this is.
Senator Sharon?
So by putting a termination date on this, I'd like the termination date in terms of the amendment, Senator Rosen, if you agree with this, is not about terminating the program, but it's about asking
for us to be informed as to whether or not it is accomplishing the asset development that it is intended to achieve. That's what I'd like to hear about.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Exactly. And perhaps an expiration date is not the way to go. Perhaps the original language, as Mr. Elwood said, for a period of 3 years, that would pull it back in. And that would give us the chance to say, okay, tell us how great this thing is.
And then, Senator Claussen, I believe you also had an oral amendment to your amendment that we haven't discussed what your changes are. So
correct.
I'm not sure if you want to talk about that before Ms. White can maybe help us with some language to get to what Senator Rosen and Sharon have been discussing.
Certainly. And perhaps before that, we could have members of the department come forward and just make a comment which is related to the amendment.
Please state your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Patrick Holman. I'm with the Department of Human Services. And I guess I'm sorry, I was in the back there and I didn't, if there was there a question, I'm sorry.
Senator Claussen.
Of a statement of your position.
Okay.
Mr.
With respect to the healthcare programs, we were just a little concerned with the original language because we're moving into the Magi world and we have to recognize the IRS rules. And we tried to get clarity from the IRS and their phone lines are a little backed up this time of year. So we were just unable to get that. But we think this takes care of it in terms of the Magi population. And we don't believe there's a fiscal note for healthcare.
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Holman. And Senator Claussen, what was your change in the A3?
Just the A3 amendment generally it just provides some additional clarification. It defines some of the terms that are involved in the proposal. And then, which we've just been discussing, it provides more time flexibility for the proposal, but we'd be very happy to accept a friendly
My
amendment.
My apologies, Senator Claussen. Sure. I thought you were going to orally amend your amendment.
Original bill.
So the A3 stands alone, and we might have an oral amendment from Senator Sharon or Rosen. Ms. White, would you like to walk us through an option to?
Sure. Madam Chair and members, to reinstate the 3-year period of time for the pilot project, I'd recommend we delete lines 1, 3, and 14 and 15 of the amendment, and that will reinstate the 3-year period of time for the pilot under Human Services and Housing Finance Agency. And then regarding the report, if you want to add a new paragraph D to the A3 amendment stating something like, the Citizens League shall provide a report to the legislative committees having jurisdiction over human services issues by July 1st of 2016, informing the legislature on the outcomes achieved by the pilot project. And Madam Chair, I'm not sure if that report date is appropriate to get back to the legislature. It seems as though they'll get back before the pilot expires.
Senator Claussen?
Madam Chair, could we say outcomes or progress? Because the, you know, we're not quite sure where in 2016 the project might be. So we certainly could come back and report on the progress or the outcomes, depending upon how the project is progressing.
Thank you, Senator Claussen. My only question was, I believe the discussion was we didn't necessarily need a cutoff date, but we wanted a report, or do we need both?
Madam Chair, if I'm interpreting the conversation here, I think the committee would be satisfied with a report update, unless I misinterpreted their comments.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Claussen, how about something like for a period of 3 years to come back to the legislature to report, something like that? So it's not really a sunset date, but it gives you a time frame to gather some information and show accountability measures.
I think that would be fine, as we've discussed here.
And I agree,
Senator,
that the language should be progress and outcomes, so that it accounts for the fact that the
they're just beginning to get this up and running, and it may not be have been implemented long enough for real outcomes to be measured yet.
So then I believe the oral amendment would just be adding the section D that Ms. Joan
yes.
read earlier and not deleting 1.3 and 1.14 and 1.15, correct?
Yes, only adding paragraph D, not eliminating 1.1, 1.14, 1.15.
Ms. White?
Okay. Madam Chair, I just want to clarify, you do want a time certain for the report back, though?
Yes.
Okay.
That aligns with the legislative session.
Okay.
So just to be crystal clear, Ms. White, can you repeat the change and the wording one more time, please?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, adding a new paragraph D to the A3 amendment, the Citizens League shall provide a report to the legislative committees having jurisdiction over human services issues by July 1st of 2016, informing the legislature on the outcomes achieved and progress made by the pilot project. Something I'll work with that a little bit with Mr. Elwood, but something like that.
Thank you. Does that satisfy members? On that, is there further discussion on the A3 amendment, including the oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair, based upon some consultation with the department, we'd like to make one other oral amendment.
And Senator Clausen.
Thank you. We need to add something for tax purposes, and so we have that. It would probably fit in on following what you've added some lines here, but on the proposal we were looking at, 1.14, after where it says Minnesota statutes, comma, chapter 2561, we need to add except that for enrollees subject to a modified adjusted gross income calculation to determine eligibility, the conditional cash transfer payment shall be counted as income if they are included on the enrollee's federal tax return as income or if the payments can be taken into account in the month of receipt as a lump sum payment. And we can get that to Ms. White.
Ms. White?
Actually, Madam Chair and Senator Clausen, that's the language that's in the A3 amendment on lines 1.16 through 1.12, I think.
Under B.
Maybe I can clarify.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and members, what you're correct that is the same language that we had for medical assistance. And now we need that same language for Minnesota Care. And so we just want to take that same language and tack it on after 256L on that line to make sure that Minnesota Care and MA are treated exactly the same because they both use the MAGI calculation.
Ms. White?
Madam Chair and Senator, another alternative is just to add... You'll have to reconsider the A3, but to add and Minnesota Care after medical assistance on 1.8 of the A3.
That would be very simpler.
Good. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So in order to reconsider the amendment, we would have moved to reconsider. Senator Clausen, reconsider the A3 amendment as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Oh, sorry. All those opposed signify by saying no. Amendment is adopted, and we are going back again to A3, and we're making another oral amendment to the A3 amendment. And Ms. White, what line would we be adding the new language?
On the A3 amendment, page 1, line 8, after assistance, insert and Minnesota Care.
Any other oral amendments that at this time? I think that achieves the intended purpose. So with that change, all those in favor of the A3 amendment as early amendment, including the addition of the Section D and the new change in line 1.8, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Senator Claussen?
I'd like to move Senate File 1338.
Any other discussion on that motion? All those, that's going to be laid for possible inclusion.
No, it doesn't.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Claussen.
Thank you so much. Yep.
Madam Chair, we appreciate your indulgence here and that of the committee in working through this. I think this bill has a lot of potential, and I look forward to seeing the results. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Senator Claussen. Senator Lori, now we will go back to Senate File 184, or not go back to it, but take it on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, we have Senate File 184 before us. This is the new Minnesota Care. With BHP funding eventually, and it's been covered a few times for us. And I do have the A6 amendment. That is what the fiscal note I was just referring to, that just in the last minutes had the word preliminary removed from the top of it, which makes it so that we can make it public. It's a difficult fiscal note, but it is there. I think it makes clear we're going to have to wind up somewhere between.
We're still waiting for the fiscal note. We're making copies.
Yes, we're making copies of the fiscal note, and it will be here momentarily. But maybe we can work off the A6 amendment, and I'll just give a few preliminary points about the A6 amendment. Really, this is the basic health plan, again, the new Minnesota Care. It's similar to the governor's proposal that we heard earlier today in that it removes the hospital cap. It removes the 4 and the 18-month renewal barriers and the ESI barriers, the employer-sponsored insurance barriers. It moves us to a MAGI standard, eligibility standard, across the entirety of the Minnesota Care program, which includes the asset test elimination. It eliminates the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Plan, and it has additional ACA conformity components to bring Minnesota Care into conformity with the Affordable Care Act. What this proposal for the new Minnesota Care does, in addition to the governor's budget proposal, is to expand the income level so that we cover the historic Minnesota Care population, those above 200%, up to 250% of federal poverty level for single adults, up to 275% for others, families, and children. This bill calls for lower premiums than the governor. There would be premiums at half the level of the governor's beginning on January 1, 2014, across the entirety of the income threshold, so all the way from 138 all the way up to 275. It has slightly enhanced benefits. It doesn't have all the enhanced benefits that it had when we were in health policy. Specifically, we don't do the transgender issue that caused some great concern. And that's not included in here, though I do believe eventually someday we ought to, in fairness, work on that. But it does cover non-emergency medical transportation as a covered benefit for MA. I think that's quite important, and it is rather inexpensive, that piece of it. We also eliminate the $1,000 copay that on top of the governor's. That's also not a terribly expensive item, but somehow the combination of these items above the governor's, I don't know if the fiscal note is here quite yet, but when it is, the numbers will jump off the page at members and the public. It is something over $500 million more expensive than the governor's. I'm not going to stand before you and pretend like we're going to be able to get the revenue in this division in order to cover this. Over the weekend, we're going to have to be doing some a deep dive into this fiscal note and see which components are able to be salvaged and which just are not. We're going to have to come much, much more close to the governor's. I had some preliminary fiscal notes earlier that had tagged us at something about $100 million over the governor and his proposals, and I think it's largely in the expansion of the income levels between 200 and 275 that I'm running into the most significant problems. But in all honesty, I have not had time to really absorb all of the interactions of these various proposals. But I have no intention of being able to carry this full cost. But would appreciate members' support in adding the A6 amendment and getting this on the table so that we can get to work on it over the weekend and do what's needed to see what we can do to move forward in Minnesota care, make positive steps in the lives and the access to health care for low-wage, hardworking Minnesotans and their families. So with that, I'd move the A6 amendment.
Mr. Senator Lurie, while we wait for the fiscal note, we can start with the A6 amendment, and then we can open it up for testimony as well. On the A6 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Against, no. Motion prevails. The A6 amendment is adopted. Senator Lurie?
Well, I went through the major provisions of the bill and how they differ from the governor's. I could do a walkthrough section by section or just open it up to members. I mean, I think it's really the governor's proposal plus carrying the income level higher, eliminating the copay, lower premiums, and some additional benefits, non-emergency medical transportation in particular.
Would members prefer to go by the changes in the
amendment? I mean, I can step through the sections if members
That'd be helpful,
desire.
Thank you, Senator Lurie.
I took notes on was the A5 and turned into the A6 just a little bit ago. But Section 1 is just requiring the federal funding for implementation to be deposited in the Healthcare Access Fund to support Minnesota care. Section 2 requires the commissioner to seek federal authority to operate the insurance program up to 75% of federal poverty. Section 3 requires demonstration projects applying for approval to show how their services will be coordinated with other services being provided by other providers and county agencies in that service area. Section 4 continues to permit the commissioner to contract with a single health plan to serve certain rural areas. Section 5 is the definition of the Affordable Care Act. Section 6 is the definition of family to conform with ACA. Section 7 defines the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace, which is now known as MinSure. Section 8 defines household income as having that meaning provided in the Affordable Care Act. Section 9 defines a participating entity. Section 10 modifies the section to require the commissioner to ensure that information on Medicare programs are on a website. Section 11 requires the commissioner to seek federal approval to implement the Minnesota Care Program as a basic health plan, allow for that basic health plan funding to come in to support the extension of Minnesota Care. Section 12 specifies that Minnesota Care shall be considered a public health care program for the purposes of 62V, that's the MinSure. Section 13 states that the covered health services shall include the current Minnesota Care benefits plus non-emergency medical transportation services beginning January 1, 2014. Section 14 makes a coordinating change to conform with the Affordable Care Act. Section 15 eliminates the inpatient hospital benefit cap effective January 1, 2014. Section 16 requires health coverage provided through Minnesota Care to have a medical loss ratio of 85%. This is an ACA requirement. Section 17 eliminates the cost-sharing requirements for inpatient hospital services. That's the one that's in addition to the governor's proposal. Section 18 is corresponding changes in previous sections. Section 19 modifies the income eligibility for families to specify the lower income limit of 133% of federal poverty, which is, as everyone knows, our Medicaid lower or upper bounds. Section 20 states that an individual who is eligible for coverage under the Minnesota Care Program is not considered a qualified individual under the ACA and is not eligible for enrollment in a QHP offered through the exchange. Section 21 modifies the income eligibility limit for single adults to specify the lower income limit of 133% of federal poverty. Section 22 makes conforming changes to the ACA. Section 23 specifies that lawfully present non-citizens who are ineligible for MA are eligible for Minnesota Care up to 275% for families with children and 250% of federal poverty for single adults. Section 24 specifies that enrollees and applicants residing in a correctional or detention facility are eligible for Minnesota Care while awaiting disposition of charges. Section 25 specifies that individuals eligible for MA are not eligible for Minnesota Care. It's one or the other. Section 26 specifies that applicants may submit their applications online, in person, by mail, or by phone in accordance with the ACA, and by any other means by which MA applications may be submitted. Section 27 requires the commissioner and the county agencies to use electronic verification through the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace, MinSure, as the primary method of income verification and may require an individual to submit additional verification to the extent permitted under the ACA. Section 28 makes coordinating changes for the ACA in terms of the effective dates of coverage. Section 29 makes a technical change, removing obsolete language. Section 30 removes a reference to disenrollment for failure to pay of premiums. This is a ACA conformity provision. Section 31 makes coordinating modifications to for compliance with ACA. Section 32 makes coordinating modifications to the access to employer-subsidized insurance language to conform with the ACA, as mentioned in the intro. Section 33 makes coordinating modifications to the other health coverage, like employer-sponsored coverage and the like, to conform with ACA requirements. Section 34 requires an individual to be a resident of the state in order to be eligible for coverage under the Minnesota Care Program as provided under the ACA. Section 35 states that payments to providers are at the same rates and conditions established under MA except as otherwise provided. Section 36 increases payments for basic care services, physician and professional services, and dental services. Section 37 makes coordinating changes to inpatient hospital rates, specifying that the rate paid is the medical assistance rate. Section 38 requires the commissioner to establish a competitive process for entering into contracts with participating entities. Coverage through these health plans must be available to enrollees beginning on January 1, 2015, and this subdivision also requires the commissioner, to the extent feasible, to ensure that enrollees have a choice of coverage from more than one participating entity within a geographic area. Subdivision 2 requires the participating entities, as a condition of contract, to document to the commissioner the provision of culturally and linguistically appropriate services, including marketing materials, to Minnesota Care enrollees. And subdivision 3 of that section 38 requires the commissioner to coordinate the administration of the Minnesota Care with MA and other state-administered health care programs to maximize efficiency and improve the continuity of care. Section 39, it makes coordinating modifications with the ACA. Section 40 modifies premiums by reducing current premiums by 50% beginning January 1, 2014. Section 41 requires the commissioners of revenue and management and budget, in consultation with the commissioner of human services, to conduct an assessment of the health care access fund as part of the state revenue and expenditure forecast in November of 2016 in order to determine whether state funding will be required after December 31st, 2019 for the administration of the Minnesota Care Program. The results of the assessment must be reported to the governor and the legislature by January 15th of 2017, along with recommendations for continuing state revenue for the Health Care Access Fund if additional state funding is determined to be needed. Section 42 is a reviser's instruction to coordinate with the repealers, and Section 43 is the repealers. And here's the fiscal note.
Great timing, Senator.
Nice timing. Stand for questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Lurie. My initial question is, what was the difference between the governor proposal and the fiscal note as it is today? Why is there such a big discrepancy?
Well, Madam Chair, again, I think the bulk of the difference comes in our approach to extending coverage between above 200% of federal poverty level. The governor's proposal stops at 200. Ours covers the existing Minnesota CARE population up to 275. And in addition to that, there's costs associated with lower premiums that are called for in this proposal, and some additional benefits and elimination of the copay, $1,000 copay. But I don't think those three, the lower premiums are going to drive a portion of the cost, but for those under 200%, the premiums aren't all that high to begin with. My understanding, but with the caveat that I really haven't had time to absorb this. I mean, this, you guys are seeing it 3 minutes after it's been made final. So, I mean, I'm going to be here trying to work on it. But my understanding of the largest portion of the expense is attributable to continuing coverage above 200%. One of the reasons for the large fiscal costs attributed to that is a couple of the reasons. First off, it would be, I believe, at 100% state federal is the assumption, because we don't have the waiver beyond in order to have the feds cover a portion of the cost. That's an open issue. I need to dig into this a bit more. And again, I mean, I guess I don't want to get into too much specificity because I haven't really absorbed it, but it's the largest piece is going to be in that expanding the eligibility above 200% of federal poverty level.
So, Senator Lurie, if I understand you correctly, there's still a question to be determined whether the 200 to 275, whether the federal government will pay matching, or where we're assuming right now that's 50-50, if that's the case, or that's the question that's still up. Okay, so the assumption is that it's 100% state
zero
funded over 200.
Zero. The assumption in the fiscal note is zero federal participation above 200%.
Thank you.
That was my understanding what was going to come, and it is, and that's going to, that's going to drive costs when we build this program and go all the way. And because of how interactions between the ACA and providing an eligibility to individuals, this is maybe still a little bit of an open question. We're going to be digging into this and seeing what we can come up with in terms of, you know, it's I believe everybody wants to see Minnesota Care survive and provide support for, you know, as many low-wage, hardworking Minnesota families as we can. But we're not certain whether by creating this program we make it mandatory that this be the only program for these individuals. If we provide that eligibility, it could preclude any of these individuals from opting to go into the exchange and buying a product. And I think the assumption in here says that the entirety of the 100,000 individuals between 200 and 275% of federal poverty level are going to need to, because of interactions with the ACA, come through this mechanism. These are some issues that we need to work on a little bit, see how far we can get. But again, I will assure members, I'm not going to try to drop a bill on you on Monday that has this high a cost for continuation of Minnesota Care. That's just not going to work.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Lori. Again, I'm losing track of some of the pieces. Minnesota Care is kind of our early version of the basic health plan, and we have contingent approval to continue it until some point in time, and then will we be forced to transition to a basic health plan? That,
maybe I'll give some of the backdrop, and it's actually really important. I probably should have started with that, because it is actually a real positive for Minnesota. Maybe I'll go back even a little farther, you know. In the Affordable Care Act, states like Minnesota, in fact, primarily Minnesota, worked hard to get a basic health plan option included in the Affordable Care Act. It was passed by Congress, signed by the president. And what the basic health plan allows is for individuals up to 200% of federal poverty level. The feds put an option out there for states that wanted to create a single program to serve these individuals. The feds would provide 95% of the advanced premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions that otherwise would have flowed to these individuals to buy plans on the private market. The feds would allow a state to have that provided to them to build that single state plan, which is very similar to what Minnesota Care is. And it is a program designed for this, you know, low-wage, hardworking family with the benefit set that really serves this population well. We've spent 20 years working on it and making sure that it is a really solid program for these hardworking families. And so it was a big win for Minnesota to get that included in the Affordable Care Act. As we're starting to roll it out, the feds, it's no secret, they're working very hard to implement exchanges in 33 states across the country. They're running into some issues in terms of bandwidth, trying to get that done. And they were very, very reluctant to actually implement the BHP and give states the guidance that states would require in order to be able to work our statutes and our budgets around what this 95% of advanced premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions would look like. Without that guidance, we just would not be able to do it at all. There were about 8 similarly situated states initially that were pushing on the feds to try to get them to come forth with guidance on the BHP. They proved very, very reluctant to do that. Again, you know, not out of animosity, but out of simply bandwidth. And they came up with different deals that weren't as good with many of these other states. But Minnesota was very persistent. We had many of our congressional colleagues come and work with us to understand the importance of the continuation of Minnesota Care with BHP funding. Carried their message back to Washington. I know that all of the leaders in healthcare in both the House and the Senate, from the Republican side of the aisle, the Democratic side of the aisle, plus the governor, wrote many letters, worked very hard to put a lot of pressure. And we did finally, standing alone, get the feds to say, okay, we will agree to make sure that we give the guidance necessary to implement the basic health plan. We are expecting preliminary guidance yet in 2013 with final rules about what the BHP would look like in the first quarter of calendar 2014 with actual funding, BHP funding available to start covering this new Minnesota Care on January 1st of 2015. That does provide us a 12-month calendar 2014 bridge to get across. The feds also agreed to extend our current 1115 Medicaid waiver for 50% federal participation for our existing Minnesota Care program with a couple of ACA conforming changes, namely the, I think we had to change the, I know we had to get rid of the hospital cap, the, you know, the insurance barriers, things like that, ACA conformity. So we're going to improve the Minnesota Care piece a bit through 2014, but we get the historic 50 cents on the dollar federal to support the calendar 2014. But that gets us to a place where beginning January 1, 2015, in the governor's proposal, which is the one that I'm more familiar with the numbers for, we get to a place where we're going to be able to provide a much better package for Minnesota Care enrollees than what they'd experience on the exchange with 85% federal financial participation. And it's a really big win for the state of Minnesota to be able to put this together. So we do have this calendar 2014 bridge to get across, but I'm very proud that we together were able to get through that and get the feds to agree to make sure that this is able to become a reality, and we are going to be much better served in Minnesota by all of our collective efforts. And you know, the governor has a very good proposal. I've got a couple of enhancements, you know, just $500 million worth.
And Senator, Madam Chair.
Well, 520, I think, if I add right. But who's quibbling?
Senator Benson.
Senator Lori, I just need an explanation. The BHP up to 200% of federal poverty guidelines, the feds would give us 95%. Is that, did I hear that correctly? But in our structure, we're getting 85%. And if I'm getting really in the weeds and somebody else needs to explain it, I need to.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, that's a fine question. The feds are going to provide 95% of what would have flowed through the individuals to buy private policies on the exchange, what the feds would have provided through the advanced premium tax credits and the cost-sharing reductions for those individuals. The way it winds up on our books, the federal financial participation for the program is at 85%.
Okay. See you later.
And
that clarifies. I'm just trying to reconcile percentages. And Madam Chair and Senator Lori, will we be, I know you're talking about having some more generous things than the governor's proposal. How does that compare to a basic health plan? And are we going to have to transition to a basic health plan at some point? Are the feds going to insist on that as part of ACA compliance? I'm just figuring out how long Minnesota Care stays as we design it.
Senator Lori.
Well, this, Madam Chair, Senator Benson, what's described in the A6 amendment is what Minnesota Care is proposed to look like. Again, you know, in the A6, it goes up to 275. Above 200 is, you know, according to the fiscal note, at 100% state costs, and we're going to have to work on that. But the bridge is the 2014 year that would look much like today's Minnesota Care. And in 2015, it would look much like it, too, and the experience of individuals other than going through the portal of the MNsure in order to gain eligibility. It's a Minnesota Care 2.0. But it is in no way mandatory on the state. I mean, it's an option that we're pursuing because it really is a really good set of benefits that provides a lot of support for these families and better affordability standards, a better package, and really works well for these low-wage, hardworking Minnesota families.
Senator Sharon.
Where I get a little mixed up, Senator Lori, is this: during this bridge time, we're operating on a 50-50 deal. After that, that's when we are able to access the tax, 85% of what a person would get if they'd gone on the exchange.
90, plus
it gets up to about 95%. Well, for the Medicaid, but not this group gets. All right, let me back up. For this bridge time that you're talking about before the implementation, it's the same relationship with the federal government as we have now under Minnesota Care. But also, we are changing our current Minnesota Care to eliminate the cap and other components that raise the cost of Minnesota Care to the federal government. But after 2015, then we move into the other program with this,
right,
the federal government's participation. So this fiscal note is relating to this bridge period of time.
Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, this is going to be ugly, but there's three distinct time periods in the upcoming biennium that we're setting our budget for regarding the Minnesota Care program. This last 6 months of calendar year 2013 are under the existing 1115 demonstration project. Those are the first 6 months of fiscal year 14, the first 6 months of the next biennium. All of calendar year 14 would be under the new 1115 Medicaid demonstration waiver with 50% matching funds for those eligible. There's a handful of individuals that wouldn't be eligible for the federal matching funds, but it's just shy of 50% federal for the program. But the program would need to get rid of the hospital cap and the enrollment barriers. And other ACA compliance. They would have to come into ACA compliance as an insurance product covering lives through calendar 2014. And then January 1, 2015, there's still 6 months left of the biennium, and that would be under the full BHP funding. And so there's three distinct time periods with slightly different funding streams for each of the three time periods during the upcoming biennium. I hope that provides some clarity.
I think that it's clear. It was clear to me. But another thing that I just sort of goes into my brain is that if we weren't doing this, if we weren't creating this, this population, the definition of what this would be the silver plan on the exchange, that we somehow have defined the silver plan on the exchange as the basic plan, the basic health plan, unless we define it differently. Is that correct?
I'm not, Senator, Madam Chair, I'm not quite following your question. If we don't do this, if we don't build... If we don't, continue Minnesota Care with BHP funding in the manner suggested by the governor or Senate File 184, these individuals would be left to just go on the exchange like any other individual. And across the rest of the country, that's a very good deal for it moves people and families forward in their accessibility to health care. But in Minnesota, it's actually a step backwards because we've worked hard to build a really affordable set of economical, good single package to provide the care for these low-wage, hardworking families. And we've got a 20-year experience of doing that well. And so our affordability standards are significantly ahead of the rest of the country, which is why this is so important to us, and it's our commitment to this that again helped move the dial in the federal level and got them to include the basic health plan option in the first part, in the first place, and then got them to agree to actually implement it through guidance and rule.
Any other questions from members? Senator Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Lori, you brought up the asset test earlier, and we talked about how the systems were being designed to not have an asset test, but we do have one for the disabled and elderly. And I just want to ask again that we consider for Minnesota Care, we go up to 275% of federal poverty guidelines based on the MAGI standard. It is possible that someone could move from a fairly comfortable place in life down quickly and have assets. And as part of cost containment and just good government, I think reasonable provisions like exempting a homesteaded home from an asset test, exempting a portion of retirement benefits from an asset test, but then making other things to count towards the asset test. It might be complicated programming, but we're asking the elderly and the disabled to comply with an asset test. So I don't think asking the question as part of enrollment is going to be that difficult. I think it's going to be a decision that we have to make if it's just to ask for people who are able to buy down maybe part of their retirement. Maybe they have $500,000 in a 401k because they did well at one point. And maybe they need to take some of that out. Maybe they have a second home or some land somewhere that they're not dependent on. And I think it's reasonable for us to consider that. We are one of the most generous states when it comes to our health care programs, and you are trying very hard to be generous and fair with this population and to protect a good Minnesota program. But I also think it's reasonable that if people have some means, that they also contribute. And so I will make that ask one more time. And if I can help, I will help. But I'm going to continue to ask. And I can work on language, but it's something you and I are going to have to talk about if you're all amenable, mm-hmm. And then I will help. Section 4, the geographic issue, negotiating with one plan. And Senator Rosen's not here to ask the rural question, so I will. Can you walk me through that section 4? What does that mean, and where would it apply? Is it based on geography? Is it based on density? Is it based on plan availability?
Senator Lori?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, the only place where the single state health plan, the single health plan basis, I think, are the county-based purchasing plans. And this would permit the commissioner to continue to contract with those single state plans to serve. And this would be particularly important in those rural communities. So it's kind of a protection of how it works today.
Senator Benson?
No, I haven't gotten a chance to go through everything. Those were just kind of the things that kept popping up.
That was actually in the last bill as well. So that one's not a surprise to anybody. Just.
Any other questions? Senator Lori, should we open it up for any other public testimony?
Sure.
Does anybody wish to testify at this point? Thank you. State your name for the record, and please proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christina Wessel. I'm the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Budget Project. We are an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and we provide independent research, analysis, and advocacy on tax and budget issues that impact low and moderate income families. And I just want to take the opportunity to enjoy this moment and come up here and thank Senator Lori for a bill that we're very excited about. And I know it's going to look different on Monday, But it's nice to be able to celebrate something once in a while. So we're really grateful that this bill has amended. Does so much to make sure that we can tell Minnesotans that we are truly creating the next generation of Minnesota care. By maintaining eligibility for individuals up to 250 and 275% of poverty, it really ensures that our working families will be able to continue to access affordable health care coverage and will have a smooth transition in 2014 as so much is changing around them. By reducing premiums, which is, I think, one of the most essential elements of what happens here, we're going to make sure that we're making an incredible difference in working families' budgets. A recent healthcare access survey found that between 14 and 23% of individuals eligible for public programs did not enroll because they could not afford it. They felt it was too expensive. So even though Minnesota Care premiums are affordable for many, this Delete All amendment really helps to make sure that it's affordable for everybody. And there's a lot of other elements in the bill, the $10,000 cap, eliminating the $1,000 coinsurance on hospital, the enrollment barrier. All of these things make sure that people can actually access and use affordable health insurance. And finally, I just want to say we greatly appreciate that the bill uses the Healthcare Access Fund to build a better Minnesota care. The Healthcare Access Fund was created to ensure that our working families could access affordable and meaningful coverage. And this bill makes sure that we use the first purpose for using the Healthcare Access Fund is for helping the Minnesota care population, and that is a really important thing. So like I said, we know we won't see all of this on Monday when the bill comes out, and I will also be enjoying poring over the fiscal note over the weekend. But I think as we look at prioritizing what we keep, as we look towards the omnibus bill, I think doing something to address the premium issue is probably one of the highest priorities, because it doesn't matter how good we make Minnesota care. If people can't actually afford to purchase it, then we haven't actually helped them. So once again, thank you. It's a nice way to end the week, enter the weekend, and we look forward to seeing what happens on Monday. Thank you, Senator Lurie. Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Ms. Wessel. Senator Lurie?
Well, you know, I don't know if anybody else has to testify, but I did neglect one thing that I meant to do right away when I got up here. I'm, you know, I was a little stunned at the size of the fiscal note, but I did want to publicly thank everyone at DHS that I know worked very, very, very hard, and at MMB to sign off on this. This was a really big task to get this ready for us to actually look at what the costs would be for this full-blown program and set us up to be able to do the work over the weekend to price out the different components and see what might be available. So with that, you know, if you can offer for more testimony, but as soon as the time is right, I would move that Senate File 184, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion.
Senator Sharon?
I want to go back to my Let me go back and first make sure I understood what you said, and that is in terms of negotiating with the federal government, it is unclear yet. I heard you say that it's unclear yet whether or not it will be required that people 250 or 275 will have to participate, must all participate in the basic health plan, or if they have the choice of doing that and going into the exchange. Did I hear that correctly?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, the issue is more around if we build this above 200, there is a program that this population is eligible for. Does that preclude them from choosing to go just the private insurance route through the health insurance exchange? I'm pretty sure that this interpretation that you'll find in the fiscal note assumes that this entire population, essentially 100,000 people between 200 and 275% of federal poverty level, will all have to come through the Minnesota care, and all at 100% state cost.
And
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. So essentially the answer to what I'm asking, if that is yes, that happens to be yes, and the fiscal note is based on that assumption, but if the alternative was that was not the case and that some might choose to go on to the exchange, my understanding is that the equivalent plan in the exchange would be the silver plan to the Minnesota care or the basic health plan, but the cost of the silver plan as compared to the Minnesota care plan would make it illogical to choose that, or and if they were staying in the exchange, this income group would probably choose a bronze plan, which has a very high deductible and a lot of copays and less coverage. So I think the assumption about what a person might choose based on the value that they get for their dollar would be your base, this basic health plan, if we are able to do it. But, you know, the person, if it may turn out that someone would have the choice, and then they go to the exchange, the equivalent plan, that's what I was talking about with the silver plan, to what is in your proposed basic health plan, or even the governor's, is the silver plan. But the cost of that, I think, would drive people right down to the bronze plan, which we don't want to have happen.
Madam Senator Chair, Lurie. Senator Sharon, that is correct.
So Senator Lurie, so the question before us, do we have the option of limiting Minnesota Care to 200?
Senator Franzen, Madam Chair, absolutely. Yes, the basic health plan funding in its core construct, it goes up to 200% of federal poverty level. If we wanted to go beyond that for Minnesota, we would have to ask for permission, and it's unclear exactly what federal participation would be available, if any, and whether it would be at 50% or at the 95% of what the feds would experience in advanced premium tax credits and cost sharing reductions. It's unclear exactly what the funding stream above 200% would look like if we were to ask and be successful in getting some. But the assumptions in the fiscal note are, I believe, no federal participation above 200%.
And my question would be, why would we assume that if we have Minnesota Care up to 275, that population between 200 and 275 okay. cannot okay. opt to go through the exchange and get their own insurance if they so wish? I don't think he's listening.
They can, they won't. They shouldn't. If they've got a good navigator.
Welcome, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members, if I may I clarify one thing as I'm looking through this fiscal note the first time as well?
Absolutely. And please state your name for the record.
I'm Lucinda Jess, and I'm Commissioner of the Department of Human Services, and thank you all for letting me intercede here. I think that Senator Lurie is very correct, and it certainly was based upon what I and others had told him, that, you know, overall, this fiscal note assumes that there's not federal participation for above the 200 to 275, except for it does assume, as I'm reading this, that there is the federal participation for the count for the year of 2014, so that it assumes in here that we'd have the continue that waiver, so the federal participation at 50% for 2014, but that after that, that federal participation would not be available. Now, I think that perhaps it could be. Maybe we could negotiate that that's the assumption in the fiscal note.
Okay.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Sharon.
And we're relying on you, Commissioner, to make sure that happens, correct? She has the influence of the federal government.
Absolutely. Senator
Lurie? I renew my motion.
See, if there's no further testimony from the audience on Senator Lurie's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion carries. The bill is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
One more? Is this it? One more?
Senate File 1281, and I believe that is the final one for today.
Two amendment, Madam Chair.
Oh.
It's making sense to me now.
While that's being passed out, maybe I'll just...
I got started getting it last night.
Senator Lurie?
We've talked about and cried about in this committee many times over the last few weeks the task before us in trying to construct a budget $323 million below the governor's, $153 below the current general fund spending level. Senate File 1281 is the reluctant admittance that, you know, if we're going to do all right by the frail and elderly in the state of Minnesota, we're going to have to generate some funds within our own budget area. And so this is a couple of options regarding surcharges. These are each of these are existing surcharges, and these are proposed increases to existing surcharges, many of them with payback mechanisms. And the A2 amendment fills in the blanks on what a lot of these are. And then also, I hope the public has been given as well, there is a summary of these surcharges and the net effect that they will have to our budget. And I want to just say also, by laying these on the table, which I hope the committee is willing to do when we're done with the testimony here, this gives us options for adding some revenue into our budget to be able to meet some of the needs within the Health and Human Services area. But these are just options on the table. It is not certain that each and every one of these would be picked up. With the A2 amendment, I'll just step through it. Section 1 of the bill with the lines filled in, Section 1 provides for a $440 per bed surcharge increase for nursing facility beds. That brings it from $2,815 to $3,255. And if you look at the spreadsheet, you can see that still we are we would be proposing to repay the nursing facilities and that amount, and then there would be some left on the bottom line for the states, about $16 million in the biennium for that. Section 2 is a 0.57 increase on hospital revenue surcharges. This would raise that existing surcharge from 1.56% to 2.13%. Section 3 is a 0.88 increase on HMO revenue surcharges. It would go from 0.6% to 1.48%. Section 4 is a $2,677 per bed surcharge for ICFDD beds. That would go from $1,040 to $3,717. Again, there would be a payback mechanism on those as well. So to hold the industry harmless and then leave a little on the bottom line for other issues within the Health and Human Services budget. Section 5 provides for instructions to the Commissioner of Human Services on reducing payments if they exceed upper payment limit on the surcharges. Sections 6 through 13 provide MA rate increases to hospitals to offset the costs of the increased surcharge. Section 6, and I certainly don't want to characterize the Hospital Association as in favor of this. They are not. But they did help us work on, if we're going to do a surcharge, how can we level out the winners and losers in our payment mechanism? It's a difficult thing to do, but if you just do a straight payback on fee-for-service Medicaid, you have terrible winners and losers, and there's mechanisms to direct it and try to level that out. And on the hospital side, we also, in aggregate, pay back more than the surcharge collected, and that helps reduce the losers. So Section 6 is a 2.88% MA rate increase for inpatient services. Section 7 increases MA payment rates for mental health and chemical dependency admissions, a total of $15,360,000 for the biennium. Section 8 increases MA payment rates for birth admissions, a total of $15 million for the biennium. Section 9 increases MA rates for critical access hospitals, a total of $2,400,000 for the biennium. Section 10 increases MA payment rates for hospitals with a high percentage of patients who are children under 18 years of age, a total of $10,560,000. Section 11 increases MA payment rates for hospitals with a high percentage of patients receiving orthopedic care who are children under 18 years of age, a total of $2,400,000. Section 12 increases MA payment rates for level one trauma centers, a total of $720,000. Section 13 increases MA payment rates for hospitals serving large Medicare populations, a total of $18 million for the biennium. Section 14 increases the payment rate for external fixed costs for nursing homes from $8.86 per day to $10.37 per bed day. And Section 15 increases the operating payment rate for ICFDDs by $7.81 per bed day from $3 to $10.81 per day. So with those offsetting rates, in general, the nursing facility and the ICFDD community are generally held harmless. The hospital community as a whole is held harmless. We actually paid back a little bit more in the hospitals, but there are still some winners and losers. We've worked very hard to build a formula to really level that out. And the HMO surcharge, there is no payback at all on that one. But that is what members can see on the spreadsheet and how it works out. And that is the Senate File 1281.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Will we see a run on the implications of this on the various facilities before we move on it in the next week?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, yes, very good question. I did try to have runs available today. They're not available today. I tried on the hospital side. We'll work. Hopefully by Monday we can have runs for each of the various types of facility. There have been runs on this in the past. I will note, I think that like on the hospital side, there's 47 net to the state on this. The you know, the other body has I think 100 million on their spreadsheet out of the hospital surcharges with just a straight up payment increase, and it's maybe we'll even pass out both runs. There is a lot of work that needs to be done on these formulas, and maybe this isn't the final iteration of the formula, but we did work with some of the stakeholders to try to get an initial stab that works as well as it can, and we can continue to work if there's outliers. Every time there's winners and losers, you got to work very hard to try to smooth it. And again, I'm not, you know, we were in very difficult budget times in previous years, and we haven't taken this up to this level. I offer these very reluctantly as options that may or may not be needed as we finish the work on the spreadsheet over the weekend.
Senator Lurie, I only ask that because, as I've said before, I like to have the information to know when I'm voting. The ask that we're making sometimes of some is greater than of others, and I want to know that I'm making that kind of an ask deliberately. So,
yep. And today, Madam Chair, when I make the motion on this, I will not move that this is recommended to pass. I don't think any one of us would recommend this pass. I will just make a motion that we lay it on the table for possible inclusion.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple quick questions. And I know, Senator Lurie, you're doing a lot of work yet. So I know you have so much to look through. But just one clarification, a couple of them actually. One is on page 2, line 30 or so. It's just for non-government-owned hospitals surcharge. Did I miss something else? Are government hospitals also going to have a surcharge, or just non-government?
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, this is just for non-government hospitals. Government-owned hospitals, there's different mechanisms already at play. We had Hennepin County Medical Center up here earlier talking about different IGT mechanisms. This hospital surcharge is a broad-based tax on the non-government facilities.
Okay.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yep. One other thing. On the HMO surcharge, then, that's going to flow directly to probably premium costs or something, because $80 million is a pretty good chunk, although in their huge entities, I don't know what percent that is, just throwing that out, since it'll have its effect downstream, I would suppose.
Senator
Lurie. Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, you know, anytime you raise revenue, it's a painful ask. And, you know, I'm assuming when we open this up, and we should, for public testimony and hear from folks, I would probably let the insurance industry answer that question.
Okay.
Do other members have any questions at this point?
Snuck up on us.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Barbara Cox from Health Partners, and I want to thank Senator Lori and the Senate also for how they have couched this proposal and that it's known that it's a difficult proposal. We appreciate how difficult it is for you. Health Partners is unique in that we are an integrated organization. We have a care delivery system as well as a health plan. So we approach this issue from both our hospitals, our three hospitals. This affects those three hospitals very differently, and our health plan. From the health plan side, I want to weigh in and just let you know that unlike the hospitals where you have winners and losers, but it depends on, you know, how much money they get back. In the case of the HMO surcharge, and I am not familiar with the exact way that this percentage would result. But in past years, when this has been considered and we have worked with the department on the runs, this has resulted, because of the way Health Partners is structured, in us basically writing a check to our competitors. So it's not just winners and losers. It makes for some significant disruption in the competitive marketplace. Because Health Partners, in past iterations of this proposal, has borne up to 80% of the cost of the surcharge.
Sarah Lori.
This isn't going to make it a whole lot better, but that was when we were trying to pay the HMOs back. In this proposal, we're not trying to pay the HMOs back, and so you're not writing the check. This is just a surcharge. So, I mean, again, I don't think it makes it a lot better.
We're not going to give it to
your competitor.
We're just going to keep it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Save the best for last. Other testifiers, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jeff Bostic and Heidi Holste with the Long-Term Care Imperative. To talk about the nursing home portion of the proposal, we represent essentially all the, as the imperative, we represent all the nursing homes in the state for all practical purposes. We want to commend the Senator Lori for bringing forward some ideas that, you know, hopefully allow us to do what needs to be done to get a good funding bill. I guess we'll see what that looks like on Monday when it comes out. So we're not here to testify against doing the surcharge necessarily. We do have some concerns about it. Obviously, our primary concern is seeing that we get an adequate increase for long-term care particularly long-term care workers out of this session. We were disappointed with what we saw out of the House bill earlier this week. If this mechanism becomes a means to an end to do a better increase out of the Senate, we'd certainly look at supporting it in the context of a solid increase in that bill on Monday. Just a couple of additional concerns to raise that you probably are aware of. The federal government has been taking a look at these mechanisms and whether to put some limits on them that may be outside kind of the time frame of the budget we're looking at here, but it's a potential risk that we'll have to go back and undo what we do here with the surcharges in the future. And the other thing is that this mechanism does impose an additional cost on private pay nursing home residents, which has been controversial in the past. It's already at $8.86 a day that they're paying for the current surcharge. This would take it to more than $10 a day, which is a pretty substantial out-of-pocket cost for those individuals. So we have some concern about that, and I think there are some other groups that probably have greater concern than we do about that.
Thank you for your testimony.
Hello, Madam Chair and members. I'm Heidi Holste with the Long-Term Care Imperative. I just want to say something a little bit differently that Mr. Bostic said. We do have a bill in this session carried by Senator Eakin that would provide nursing homes a 5% MA rate increase. If the proposal went forward as is, the long-term care imperative would consider this a tax on nursing homes because it does provide a $16 million savings to the state bottom line. If there was a comparable increase or a more of an increase that is provided on the bottom line here, it would not be considered a tax. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Do members have any questions? Thank you again. Welcome again, Ms. Krinke.
Yeah. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. We're going to just take a minute to walk through the arcane and technicalities of the Minnesota of the hospital surcharge and how it works and doesn't work. And I have some comments that are both philosophical as well as some technical concerns. Just on a philosophical basis, as you've heard from the other groups, surcharges do create winners and losers. And it's just by the nature of our patient mix. And what you have to understand for the surcharge, it is collected on all hospital revenues minus your Medicare patient revenue. Okay, so last year in 2011, hospitals paid in $126 million to support programs at DHS. So already we're not necessarily in love with a surcharge already, if I can say that, and Senator Lori knows that. But what happens with the payback methodology is depending on how much Medicaid patients you have, you tend to get more of the money back, and other hospitals tend to be losers. I would like to really thank Senator Lori, even though I'm speaking against it, that what Senator Lori has tried to do with these different buckets, if I can call them that, with the payback methodology, he is seeking to flatten the difference between the winners and losers, okay? So just looking at the Representative Huntley's bill on the House side, and this has all just come about in like the last 2 days, so we're still trying to do the analysis. But what Representative Huntley does in his proposal is to put all the payback into just a flat Medicaid rate. And our initial analysis is looking at there might be about 12 winners and about 87 hospital losers.
In the House.
So what Senator Lori has tried to do with his proposal by doing that pediatric add-on. Now think about this from a children's hospital's perspective. They have no Medicare business. So then the surcharge impacts all of their revenue, which is why we have two of the buckets that are pediatric buckets in there. So what Senator Lori is trying to do is to make the surcharge as less impactful as possible, okay? Now, that doesn't mean we like it, but we appreciate what he is trying to do with it. I know that's a little strange. But I need to just tell you one other thing with surcharges, and I was appreciative of what Mr. Bosick said. The federal government is really starting to look at surcharges, particularly in light of the ACA, and they're putting a lot of money into the Medicaid programs around our country. So they're saying, well, maybe we shouldn't do a lot of these surcharges and provider taxes anymore, and we are very concerned that these type of funding mechanisms may not have a long lifetime. So that's the first point. Now the second point, and I'm going to talk with my hands, which is really going to be a little strange here, but it's important, okay? So, there's this little thing called the upper payment limit, and the upper payment limit is your Medicare payments are here, and the Medicaid payments are here, and the federal government will not allow Medicaid payments to exceed Medicare payments, okay? So what is going to happen with the surcharge is you pay this big surcharge on all your revenue, and then you try to squeeze the money back into the Medicaid rate, and hospitals will hit an upper payment limit. So there's a chance we may not be able to accept the additional revenue. So I know it's kind of technical, but we are worried about how that plays out over time, particularly in light of the Medicare cuts that are coming our way. There's this little thing called sequestration that started April 1st. Hospitals now have a 2% rate cut that went into effect April April 1st. The ACA includes $2 billion in Medicare cuts, so we are getting increasingly worried that the Medicare payment rate keeps dropping, and so we're not really quite sure how much upper payment limit room there will be. I know that this is a little confusing and a little technical, but I just want people to understand that it may not work quite the way Senator Lori hopes it might work. So there's also sort of the philosophical problem that we have that is taxing or assessing, you can choose which word you like, but asking the provider community to help support programs that we think, quite frankly, should be paid for out of the general fund. So there is sort of a philosophical problem about why isn't this funded through general fund revenue instead of from providers? So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Any questions from members?
You agree.
Any other testifiers? Seeing none, Senator Lori?
I'd move that Senate File 1281 as amended be laid on the table for possible inclusion.
With that, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those no signify by saying no. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Too.
And thank you for the long hours over the last couple of weeks.
Absolutely. I think we did. The committee stands adjourned.